Hello, everyone. Good evening. We're calling the June 2nd meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. Can you please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. That was Derek. Thank you very much. Roll call of members.
Deborah Dawson. Henry Granison.
Present.
Rich John.
Here.
Anna Kellis.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Horman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Nice.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna.
Here.
Glenn Morey.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson. Leslie McBean Claiborne.
Present.
13 members present.
Thank you, Kathy. As always, I want to take a moment and acknowledge that most of the legislature, if you're watching this meeting, you'll see them in little rectangular boxes on your screen. But Dan Klein and I are in the legislature chambers. Presentation proclamations, petitions, communications. I have one proclamation. Are there any communications, Kathy?
They've been distributed.
They've been distributed. Thank you. And I'm always proud and happy to read this proclamation. Proclamation says, whereas Tompkins County has been a leader in supporting and fighting for the human rights, dignity, and respect of all people, and whereas Tompkins County was one of the first counties in the state of New York to pass a local law, number 6-1991, amended in its entirety in 2004 as local law number 1-2004, commonly known as local law C, to protect against discrimination based on gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation. And whereas, in passing this law, Tompkins County reaffirmed its commitment and responsibility to act to ensure that all its residents are afforded equal opportunity to enjoy a full and productive life and ensures that the rights of all residents to make their own choices, follow their own beliefs, and conduct their lives as they see fit are protected. And whereas the June 1969 riots at Stonewall Inn in New York City precipitated the modern fight for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer questioning, intersex, and asexual LGBTQ plus rights. And whereas another more local landmark incident, the Ithaca 50, 2004 lawsuit in which 25 same-sex couples who were denied marriage licenses sued the state of New York, claiming that marriage prohibition was unconstitutional, further highlighted Ithaca and Tompkins County's commitment to LGBTQ plus rights, in this case supporting marriage equality. And whereas more LGBTQ plus residents of Tompkins County are living openly more than ever before, and whereas LGBTQ plus residents of Tompkins County have been and continue to be vital to our economic development, diverse cultural landscape, sustainability, and safety across all fields and professions, including military service, law enforcement, emergency responders, educators, and elected officials, and whereas, according to President Obama, our nation, and I quote, has made great strides in recognizing what these brave individuals long knew to be true in their hearts, that love is love, and that no person should be judged by anything but the content of their character. Now, therefore, I, Leslyn McBean, Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, upon recommendation of the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, do hereby call upon all members of our community to join me in celebrating the contributions of our LGBTQ plus residents and renew our commitment and actions to eliminate prejudice everywhere it exists. And do hereby proclaim June 2020 as LGBTQ plus Pride Month in Tompkins County, and direct that the Pride / Rainbow flags shall be flown at county flagpoles during Pride Month as a symbol of our steadfast belief in the equal dignity of all Tompkins County residents. Signed this second day of June 2020. And I do want to say that the Pride flags have been flying in chambers. You probably can't see, but it is displayed right here in chambers as well. So thank you very much to all my colleagues and to all of Tompkins County for joining us in celebrating Pride Month. Can I have a hand clap? Can I have a cheer? Anything? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay. Kathy Jett from Finger Lakes Pulse is on to accept the resolution.
Who is here?
Kathy Jett.
From Finger
Lakes. Oh, hi, Kathy.
Hi, Leslyn.
Oh, there you are. Thank you for being here to accept this resolution from the Tompkins, this proclamation from the Tompkins County Legislature. Would you like to say anything?
I would, please. I want to thank you for this LGBTQ plus Pride Month proclamation. As you know, Pride Month is about refusing to keep your mouth shut when there is a chorus of prejudice spewing their song of hate all around you. It's about singing an entirely different song than the masses. It's about having the courage and the guts to raise your voice and belt out a bold new song of justice, even when you are the only one singing the song and are deeply afraid. It's about understanding that real change requires you to get uncomfortable physically and emotionally. It's about doing the right thing. The LGBTQ plus rights movement is about fighting with everything you have in your body for all of humanity. As a representative of Finger Lakes Pulse, I am grateful for Tompkins County's continued recognition of the LGBTQ plus community, for flying the rainbow flags on all the county buildings and continuing to work diligently to support inclusivity and equity for all members of Tompkins County. May we come together in support of all of those oppressed, and may Tompkins County continue to be a beacon in peace and solidarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. That was very moving. Right on point. Thank you very much, Kathy Chet, on behalf of Finger Lakes Pulse for accepting this proclamation.
Thanks, Leslyn.
I can contain myself here, Kathy. We'll move on to privilege of the floor for the public. Is there anybody from the public who wants to speak to us? Did we have any attendees? And I don't remember seeing any anything come across an email.
No.
All right.
Are they able to identify themselves? Can they raise their hands?
I don't think we have anyone with here.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Privilege of the floor. Now this is municipal officials. And I know George is joining us today. Any other municipal officials joining us? Hard to see these little boxes' names. No, just George. Hi, George McGonigal from Ithaca City Council, First Ward Representative.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, George.
I just got out of the truck. I'm not really well prepared. I do have an answer for a question I got last month about the wastewater treatment facility having its digesters cleaned. I spoke with C.J. Kilgore, who runs the facility, and I guess he'd already spoken to Mike and also to Dan. And the story is that sludge or leachate from landfills will not be affected at all. So Dryden's off the hook. But from June to August, the digesters are being cleaned, and occasionally trucked waste may have to go somewhere else. All those truckers have been notified of this and encouraged to find second destinations. Does that answer that question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I'll just tell you a few of the things that's on our agenda for tomorrow. Tomorrow's Common Council meeting. We are going to vote on requesting from the state government the ability to enact a city-based room tax for hotels and motels and also for Airbnbs. We have to do that before the legislature will take it up and before the governor will approve or disapprove. And it's going to take several months, we think. So it's really kind of a cross-your-fingers situation. Because the conference centers don't know yet for sure whether this important tax will be passed, but we think it will because the state's already ponied up $5 million for the project. Another important issue we'll be talking about is an ordinance change some of the zoning on the waterfront, specifically on Cherry Street, to make some minor adjustments that would allow for more green space, go from 100% lot coverage to 70% lot coverage, which is actually more in keeping with mixed-use zoning in other parts of the city, and some other things as well. Also, the mayor is proposing that we buy a COVID testing workstation. I don't know if you guys are buying one as well, but that's on the agenda. And a couple member filed resolutions dealing with rent subsidies and tenants and landlords. I haven't read them thoroughly, so I can't explain them to you accurately or in detail. But one stems from meetings between a local group calling for rent forgiveness between them and the mayor and Ducks and Nyan. And the other is a member filed from Steve Smith of the Fourth Ward. That's all I've got.
Thank you, George. Questions for George? Mike Sigler and then Martha Robertson.
Hey, Georgie, I was actually going to ask you about that, the rent forgiveness. It didn't look that way to me. It looked like the city, at least the one resolution, was supporting like a voucher program like the CDGB fund.
I think
maybe
that's,
I'm mistaken on that.
That's Steve Smith's, I believe.
Really? See, I thought the one was for that, and then Steve Smith was the one that supports like the Senate and the Assembly bills that are making their way through the legislature.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. I've switched them.
Okay. Yeah, I know, because I've been reading the Ithaca Tenants Union postings, and it doesn't seem to really capture what you guys are doing. I mean, I hope you don't vote to cancel 3 months of rent. I don't even know if you can do that. So that's why I'm a little confused by the whole thing.
Join the club.
That is right. Martha?
Thanks, Osmond. There you go, George. That's an honest, you know, by tomorrow night, you'll know all about it because that's when your meeting is. So, what did you say the city is looking into buying? You went past.
Oh, it's called a Rionix Encompass MDX workstation to enhance COVID-19 surveillance testing.
Okay, that. It sounds like what we last meeting approved $50,000 to, I guess, to the hospital to buy. Is that what you're thinking?
Probably. And okay. Savante is suggesting that we pay for one as well.
Yeah, okay. It's the same thing.
Okay, great. I wasn't sure. All right. Thanks very much.
I didn't explain it very well. Sorry.
Hope you'll support it. Thank you.
Anyone else? Henry?
Yes, George, I know that the governor announced that summer camps can open on June 29th this month. Have you guys given any thoughts about opening up summer camps?
I believe the answer is no, simply because it takes so long to hire a part-time staff for which we have no money. And so financially and time-wise, I don't think we could get our camps ready, our youth bureau camps ready by the end of the month, unfortunately.
Isn't there background checks?
Pardon me?
Sorry, that was out of turn. I'll raise my hand.
So the answer is no. There's no plans to open the camps.
Okay, thanks.
Anna Kellis, did you have a question?
Just as a follow-up to that, I was curious if I understand, and maybe Leslin, you and George together would be able to answer this, but there are background checks that are extensive that are necessary also for summer camps and timing and getting people enrolled. So there are logistics issues, right, as well?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
That it, Anna?
Yeah, I'm sure George and I can hash out housing for the rest of our lives together. So we'll just do that over a something sometime.
All right. Anything else for George? George, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you all. I'm going to leave early. My daughter and her family had to leave Philadelphia yesterday and looting a block away. So I'm going to go spend time with them.
Well, I'm glad that they're safe.
Me too. And I don't pray very often. I pray that the violence stops and that real change is made for the better. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, privilege of the floor for legislators. Legislators, you have stuff you want to talk about? Amanda, followed by Mike Lane.
Okay, thank you. I didn't think I was going to end up going first, but but I will. I guess I'm just going to say that I'm pretty disheartened and saddened by everything that's going on right now. And as you know, I'm a writer, and I don't usually run out of words, but I kind of don't have any words right now. But I do have a poem that I'd like to read, and I've actually read it out loud at legislature before. And I guess, you know, I believe in books and I believe in words, and I encourage all of you to pick up a book, to read about what you don't know about, and to educate yourselves, whatever that means. And I believe in poetry, and I think that poetry and art can really change people's perspectives. And so I'm going to read this poem. It's out of an edited book that I mentioned last year that our current Tompkins County Poet Laureate, Melissa Tuckey, put together. She was the editor. It's called Ghost Fishing, an eco-justice poetry anthology. And if you don't know where to start in finding a book about social justice, get this book. It's thick. It's full of amazing poetry that will give you a lot of insight. So this is a poem by Ross Gay. And I'm going to read it tonight in honor of George Floyd. And it's called A Small Needful Fact. Is that Eric Garner worked for some time for the Parks and Recreation Horticulture Department, which means perhaps that with his very large hands, perhaps in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants, which most likely, some of them, in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe. Thanks.
Thank you, Amanda. Mike Lane.
Yes, thank you, Amanda. That was lovely and very fitting. We're all very upset about what's going on out there, much as George McGonigal just said to us, and I know we're going to talk more about it later in the meeting, best we can. I wanted to point out tonight, which I'm very pleased on our board to see Michelle Coco's name, who's been our deputy clerk, who is our deputy clerk, and nice to see her back in the saddle helping us out at our meeting tonight. That's all I'd like to say tonight.
Well, thank you, Mike. I didn't even see Michelle Coco's name until you said that. Hi, Michelle. Glad you could join us. Mike Sigler and then Anna Kellis.
Hi, thanks. Actually,
you're muted, Mike.
You were nice and loud, and you're saying something profound, but we can't hear you. We still can't hear you.
Better?
Yeah, so now you have to start over.
No problem. No, the question I was asking George was, because I didn't see anything on his agenda about the rent, but now I do, because apparently Duxton put this on the agenda either Sunday or Monday. He's coming forward with a resolution that is asking basically the state to allow the mayor to basically forgive rent for tenants in the city of Ithaca. I don't know. I actually feel kind of blindsided by this resolution because a lot of people have been asking me about it, and I'm like, listen, I don't see it on the agenda. So to all those people that have been asking me about it, I apologize. It was not on the agenda as of Sunday and as of Monday morning. So it is on there now. Obviously, I think it's a terrible idea. You know, if you're just going to forgive tenants' rents and you're still going to make landlords pay taxes. I don't really understand how that works out for anyone. But that is on their agenda for tomorrow night, and it's a member-filed resolution. And if people want to show up and ask Duxon why he thinks that's a great idea, then they should probably do that. So that's about it.
Thank you, Mike. Anna Kellis?
Thank you, Leslyn. I just wanted to add my voice. I can't speak as eloquently as the poet that Amanda read, but I did want to add my voice right now. I think that it's very important that that we all do speak up. I think that they're acknowledging the sadness and the hurt and the pain is really important. But I also think that it's really important to not stay silent, to learn for all of us as much as possible in the white community. Something that I think many of us have discovered more and more and more, the extent of our privilege. And I think it's really important that we speak up. Someone who is a very close friend of mine recently said, for all of us to also reach out to our Black and Brown brothers and sisters in the community, know that it is a very hard time. And don't stay silent, reach out and see if they need an ear or how to support. I think it's also important that we don't try and lead anything, but we do hold each other accountable to learn. There's some amazing resources that are going around the internet right now on Facebook. I highly encourage all of us. I've posted some. I've seen others post some. There are documentaries, I think, movies, The Hate We Give. It is on my homework list, and I wanted to mention it as something that has been recommended to me. I also wanted to say that there are actions happening at the state, and we have an opportunity. I just heard from one of my state colleagues that there is a resolution on the floor in the state legislature next, I think it will come up next Thursday, and that is the repeal of Section 50A, and that is in the Assembly Bill 2513. I will repeat, 2513 is what that number was, but it is the repeal of Section 50A, and that is specifically to require transparency from our law enforcement across the state, that they will not have discretion to withhold body camera videos or disciplinary actions taken, personnel records in general. That ability of discretion and having it be private information will no longer be possible. So I think that this is really important for everybody to educate themselves on, to look at, and to champion. It came up too quickly for a resolution tonight, so I wanted to just make sure everybody was aware of it and to contact our representatives.
Thank you, Anna. Martha.
Thank you, Leslyn. I think the public may, anybody watching may not know that we'll be considering a member filed resolution drafted by Leslyn, Annie Corman, and Ken Clark, our Director of Human Rights, in a little bit. And so I know that there'll be a lot of discussion about what's going on in the country in that context. So it may actually feel odd that we're not really diving into it right now, but it's hard to actually think of kind of anything else at this point. And I'll just say a little piece here saying that my heart is sick for what's going on. And when I layer over it, the pandemic, when we're working so hard to tell our residents that they need to stay physically apart, they need to wear masks, they need to only go out when absolutely necessary, and people around the country feel it's absolutely necessary to go out, and they're right, but I so worry about what will show up in a couple of weeks as far as the pandemic. So it's such a sad time, such a terrible time right now. But I did want to give my usual update, which is on state and federal issues, but basically on federal, which is basically that there's like not much going on with the HEROES Act or the SMART Act, the several bills that are under consideration for state and local aid from the federal government. I would encourage people still to, if you have the stomach and if you have a moment, to call and tell all, you know, our senators and congressperson that they really need to support the HEROES Act, which has the right kind of support for local governments, for schools, and state governments. That's the phone number again, 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. And just, that's the switchboard. Just ask for Congressman Tom Reed, and tell him how you feel about anything, actually. Doesn't have to be about federal funding. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Martha, and I appreciate the acknowledgement how hard it is to just carry on as usual when we have so much going on in our world. I'm going to take a moment. Amanda, you must have been in my head. I, too, love poetry and love books. And a dear friend of mine, former attorney at Ithaca College, Trevina Bird, posted a poem, one of my favorite poems, and I came in here wanting to share that because, as Martha said, with everything going on, there's that expectation that you just continue business as usual, and for, I want to speak for myself, and I don't want to speak for the entire Black community, but for Black and brown folks, just about every day we have to put on that mask and keep going and pretend sometimes like nothing has happened when underneath that mask there's such hurt and pain. So this poem is by Paul Laurence Dunbar, American poet who was born in the month of June, 1872, to freed slaves in Kentucky, and it's called We Wear the Mask. African-American or Black poet says, we wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts, we smile and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but, O great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but oh, the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask. We don't have any. Oh. Henry.
Yes. That was a nice reading, Leslin. People don't know that I moved to Ithaca from Minnesota, from Minneapolis, in fact. In fact, my brother-in-law still lives in Minneapolis, within blocks of where things went down. But he told us that, because the media's not covering sort of how much support they're getting, how the police know neighborhoods, how people are coming up each day, removing glass from the streets. Also, the birdwatch in New York City, he went to college with me. we graduated together in the same time. I'm amazed at how he was able to handle the situation. I'm not sure I would have been able to do that. I also want to read something from John Lewis, the old-time civil rights guy and congressman who's dying. But he said, to the rioters here in Atlanta and across the country, I see you. I hear you. I know your pain, your rage, your sense of despair and hopelessness. Justice has indeed been denied for far too long. Rioting, looting, and burning is not the way. Organize, demonstrate, sit in, stand up, and vote.
Yep. Thank you, Henry.
Thank you.
Have to vote. Remind people to do that. I am going to rearrange our agenda for a little bit before I get to county administrator and finance director, etc. We have a resolution that needs to be added to the agenda, and if it's okay with everyone, I'd like for us to really take action on it at this point. So, Annie, yeah, people keep moving around on this screen. I don't know where Annie is anymore. There you are. Annie, can you move to add your resolution J to the agenda?
Yes, before I do, I had one word to change in it. Should I change? Can I change that now? Or like?
Why don't you just go ahead and add it, and then you can change it after it's been added. You can make a quick and small amendment.
So add it afterwards. Okay, I'd like to move that this resolution be added to the agenda. It's a resolution condemning the killing of George Floyd and the institutional racism which permeates our society.
May I have a second? Seconded by Anna Kellis. And can I... Were you raising your hand for discussion, Martha? I can't tell.
Yeah.
People move as soon as something happens, and then... Yes?
I was hoping we might consider a unanimous second.
Wait, this is just to add it to the agenda.
Okay.
Henry, is your hand still up, or you just never took it down? I like your hand. I just, you know, want to know. All right, we need a roll call vote. 10 to add it to the agenda.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grangerson?
Yes.
Rich Dunn?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mooring?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shona Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. It's added to the agenda, and then I will just go ahead and take action on this resolution at this point. So now you get to move it again for a vote. Ms. Annie.
Okay, thank you. I would like to move the resolution condemning the killing of George Floyd and the institutional racism which permeates our society. I'd like to move that to the floor.
And this is Resolution J, ID 9377. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm going to ask for a unanimous second by our legislators. And I have a show of hands on our screen. Anybody who is seconding the resolution? Is anybody who doesn't want to second the resolution? That is seconded unanimously. Thank you very much, legislators, for that. Thank you. Annie, you want to speak a little bit to it?
Yes, thank you. I would also like to read it in its entirety. But first I want to thank Dr. Kenneth Clark for writing the bulk of this, and Leslyn, and all the other legislators for helping support this and rewrite it into something that I feel very strong about, that helps us to bear witness to the collective pain that we see in the United States and around the world, and the collective call for action. I believe this is just one small thing that we can do, but I think it's a very necessary thing that we are doing. It's a first step in bearing witness. And so I'm going to read this, and then I'd like, Madam Chair, I'd like to, if we could have Kenneth Clark speak a little bit on it. And I've read it through several times, but right now I'm having trouble, so I would like to know if somebody would be willing to continue reading it if I have trouble. Is there anybody that wants to volunteer?
Martha has raised her hand.
Thank you. Okay. Whereas the Tompkins County Legislature cannot stay silent when Black people across our nation continue to die in police custody, and when sleeping, jogging, and birding while black is criminalized and people of all races take to the streets and protest. And whereas we condemn the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, just a few of the many unarmed African Americans we have lost this year, we denounce the terrorization of Christian Cooper this week in New York City Central Park. And whereas these contemporary acts of police brutality, vigilantism, and the criminalization of Black men and women reflect historic patterns of institutional racism that prohibit equity and opportunity for African Americans. And whereas, although progress has been made, there remains much unfinished business in the pursuit of racial equity and justice. The historic and current realities of racism represent a singular, persistent stream of brutal, oppressive force that has yet to be mitigated. And if Martha, if you would continue from here.
You bet. And whereas the confluence of these recent events stands in bold relief against the backdrop of a global pandemic that has claimed over 100,000 American lives, COVID-19 lays bare glaring health and social disparities affecting Black people. And whereas not only do these disparities drive cumulative disadvantage for Black men, Black women, Black families, and Black communities, the social poison of racism also has a negative impact on the overall health and well-being of American society at large. And whereas as a public health crisis, the illness of racism must be confronted not only by its victims, but by persons of goodwill of all backgrounds. And whereas Tompkins County, including our Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee and our Human Rights Office, is committed to combating racism by working with African American and other regional stakeholders interested in creating a more just and equal community. Now, therefore, we, the Tompkins County Legislature, pledge to continue to promote awareness, understanding, constructive dialogue, and education regarding diversity. And furthermore, we pledge to adhere to zero tolerance for expression of discrimination, bias, harassment, or negative stereotyping towards any person or group.
I'm going to thank you, Martha. I'm going to chime in there. The word that I wanted to change was in the second to last resolve, and I'm going to read the whole sentence. It would be changing out diversity to inequity. So that would be read, resolved that we, the Tompkins County Legislature, pledged to continue to promote awareness, understanding, constructive dialogue, and education regarding inequality.
You mean inequity? Or inequality? I'm not sure. You said inequity first, and then you just read inequality.
I meant to say inequality, but I might be okay with either word if anybody...
We'll go with inequity.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that change. Other discussion, other comments? Martha's your hand up?
Yeah, but go ahead, Shauna. I saw Shauna at the same time.
Okay, Shauna?
Yeah, thank you, Annie and Reverend Ken and Leslin for writing this resolution. And I also have really battled having the right words to say. I believe that discrimination is the greatest threat to a community built on belonging and acceptance. It really cuts to the core of who we are and what we believe in. I'm sure that I and others stand with Black Lives Matter, and we reject racism, bigotry, and hate. I'd be remiss to talk about recent events without also acknowledging the painful truth that many in our county still experience discrimination, something that is the very opposite of our mission of inclusion and diversity. We still have work to do, and we're continuing to take action on our commitment to fighting discrimination. One way we're connecting with our community is engaging in dialogue and conversation. We're going to look to our commissioners from the Human Rights Commission for help. Each commissioner has applied, attended meetings, and been engaged for the past year and beyond. Now is the time for the hard work. We will look to them for suggestions on how to engage, educate, and provide service to our community. I'd like to thank Gladys Bringman, who is here right now. She's the chair of the Human Rights Commission, the commissioners, and Reverend Clark for their time, commitment, and patience as we navigate forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Lots of hands popped up. Martha, and then Deborah, and then I'd like to call it on Dr. Carr.
Most of you know that our grandson is living with us this summer. Folks might not know that he was adopted from Zambia when he was a toddler. 15 years ago, he's now 5'10". We went for a long, healthy walk today. And he's been trying to get, he's enrolled in an online phys ed course, and he's supposed to get his heart rate up and blah, blah. So he wanted him to get more speed out of it than I could produce walking with. So I said, Ricky, why don't you run ahead, run up to that mailbox, and then come back to me, you know, a number of times on our walk. It did not, you know, I couldn't stop thinking about, here's this tall black kid running down the street by himself. So I didn't want him to run beyond where I could see him. And I'm so sorry that so many of our people live that way every day. I'm sorry. And it's just got to stop. So I look forward to hearing from Dr. Clark and from Gladys Bragman and talk about what we can actually do in this community, because it's got to stop.
Thank you, Martha. Deborah?
Yeah, thank you. I kind of at bottom today listening to Donald Trump say that I am your president of law and order. No, he's not, because the only law and order he wants to recognize and acknowledge it as legitimate is the law and order that the police administer on behalf of white people and very fine people like the white supremacists in Charlottesville. This resolution is, there's certainly nothing to argue about, but it's just pretty words. And I agree with the words, but I also think we need to move forward and take some real steps to make sure that this crap doesn't happen and keep happening the way it has been. If a man or woman cannot administer justice fairly and equitably, we should not put them in a uniform, and we should not put a gun in their hand, and we should not send them out on the street and give them the authority of law. I went to the memorial on the Commons this weekend, and I saw these signs that say ACAB and 1312, and I had no idea what that meant. I had not come across that before. It means all cops are bastards, which I find a deeply, deeply offensive sentiment. But on the other hand, I guess I can understand why people would feel that way. That is not an effective way for us to deal with this problem. But until we all take responsibility to make sure that nobody's out on the street enforcing the law unless they can do it equitably and fairly, then we run the risk that sentiment is going to gain traction. And in this connection, I wanted to bring to your attention a New York Times editorial that appeared yesterday, written by a man named Brandon Del Pozo, who was a chief of police in Burlington, Vermont, and a New York City police officer for 19 years. And it's called Justice is About More Than the Killing of George Floyd. And you'll forgive me if I read from this. I guess tonight's the night we're all going to read. The nation's police need to start acting and speaking in unison, in ways that bring police together. They have to unite in taking responsibility for the flaws in the profession and adopt a set of standards and values that may well mean treating a colleague rather than a suspect as the greater threat to public safety, especially one who puts his knee on a handcuffed man's neck until he dies. After years of suffering under threat of violence and indignity, Americans will no longer tolerate not knowing who will be next, worrying it could happen anywhere, and thinking it will happen at the hands of officers who adore their president. This is more than about the killings. If you listen to the stories people tell, the killings are simply the worst outcomes of a persistent pattern of mistreatment and violence, and bias, rather. America's cities are burning because the police are the mirror of our flawed nation. Our workforce is everyone to see where citizens truly stand in relation to one another. It reflects our values and prejudices, our glories and sins, our successes and failures. The police are called to respond to the crises in our broken communities, but their reactions often embody the very things that broke them in the first place. So, to my colleagues on the legislature and to my friend Derek, who I know is doing the best he can, we need to take action. This stuff's got to stop. And I hope that while we speak the pretty words, we walk our talk. So, thanks.
Thank you, Debra. Ann Coleman, then Rich Young.
I'd be willing to wait till Ken Clark talks.
Okay. Rich Young.
Sorry. I can certainly wait, too. But, Madam Chair, I wanted to just note that our sheriff is on the call with us, and I'd love to give him a chance to speak as well.
Thank you. I saw him. Thank you. So while the resolution is on the floor, and I'll get to Ken in a minute, I wanted to take my opportunity to say something. I got a text message. Some of you might have seen me searching my phone. I was looking for it from someone who is a former police chief. And he sent me this text message, and I wanted to read it because it was probably the first reach out to me when all of this went down, when this killing and murder, I'm not going to describe what happened as a thing or this or an event. It was a murder. He says, I know I'm not chief anymore, but I wanted to reach out to you and tell you that I am outraged at what I saw in the form of an innocent and unarmed man being murdered by a person wearing the uniform of a police officer. I make zero offers of any justification for this in any way, and I'm usually cautious to offer any opinion short of all the facts. I'm sickened to the core and cannot begin to imagine how the family is feeling. To that end, the community of Minneapolis and the community of color in this country are rightly angered, frustrated to the point they are. I'm hoping justice will be swift and appropriately harsh to the officers involved, both directly and complicitly standing by, watching a man die at the hands of a soulless man lacking any humanity. Our community has been through so much, and we've been trying to work hard to build trust between our officers and citizens, and today I'm at a loss and speechless. The rest of it was just personal to me. That for me was the realest acknowledgement of what happened. I have said this and I'll say it again. For those out there who think that what you need to do is change the narrative about what is happening, and the focus is now on the violence and the looting and whatever else and the tear gas, I ask you to take a moment and ask yourself, why do you feel the need to do that? Why do you feel the need to not focus on what is the root reason of why a black man would be murdered in broad daylight by someone who swore to protect and serve? I've watched people talk about, we got to stop with the destruction of property, the property, the property. And I say, do you really want to balance a man being murdered with the destruction of property? Is that really what you want to do? To those officers who were just standing by and doing nothing, shame on you. I'm at the point where I don't want the video after the fact anymore. I need people to do more than just take a video and then we can all see it after somebody is dead. We can't bring them back. don't call me after my son or my husband or my friend is dead. Don't call me then. Let's do something. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not asking people to jump on police. I would never advocate for that. But I don't expect you to stand around and watch someone get the life sucked out of them and not be yelling and screaming and saying, get off of them. That video tears me up. To watch an officer with his knee on someone's neck, hand in pocket like you are just making a walk in the park. That is not okay. By any means. So yes, we don't like the violence and the looting and the whatever else is happening. But people are speaking. People are speaking and they need to be heard. I'm thankful to the former chief who sent me that. Because this, what has happened over and over again about the protection of the people in blue and the protection of the people who wear the uniform, it is time we start speaking out. Too many black and brown people are dying at the hand, unarmed, are dying at the hands of our law enforcement. And most of them are not getting convicted of anything. Of the 70-something people that I can recall within the last few years who died at the hands of law enforcement, I think there were 3 convictions. That is not okay. We cannot sit back and be okay with this. Not at all. And I hear you, my colleagues. I appreciate this resolution, but I'm with you and I say we have to do more. It's got to be more than this. And it is time for community, for colleagues, for people who are white and who have the ability and the privilege to be heard to take action. Too often people are asking me to take the action to fix the thing that I didn't create, the thing that's killing me and my brothers and sisters. I will be there with you shoulder to shoulder so we do it together. But don't ask me for the solution. I can probably tell you what it should be, but no one is going to listen. You have got to. I didn't create this problem. It was created a long time ago. So please, I am pleading to the folks out there. We wait for our community and our group of Black Lives Matter to come up and fix the problem. We highlight it. We've been asking and begging and pleading for our lives. And I imagine that when this is done, I'm probably going to get some hate mail because it's not new. And I've learned to deal with it. But we have been begging. We have been asking. We have been pleading for this madness to stop. For this senseless killing and murder to stop. I don't want my child, and I have grown children, or your child, as a matter of fact, to be stopped and trying to pull out the cell phone to call someone and end up being dead. The murder of Philando Castillo was just outrageous. all of them, Stephen Clark, in the backyard of his grandmother's house. Tamir Rice, 12-year-old. And so many more. Like, it really, it tears me apart. And so I am appealing to all of us that we've got to move past just words. We have to. I read that poem because day in and day out, I'm sitting here and I'm expected to put on the mask and carry on like everything is okay. It's not okay for me. It is not, and it should not be okay for you at all. Thank you all for letting me just spew for a moment. And thank you to those of you who found the courage, not knowing what you should or could say, to even just reach out and give me a phone call or a text message to just say, I don't know what you're going through, but I want you to know I'm thinking about you. Thank you for that. It meant the world to me. Reverend Clark.
Good evening. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for your very powerful and heartfelt words, and also, too, for your input to this resolution, as well as Annie. Thank you as well for helping me in the shaping and the crafting of this document, which is now a resolution, and to the legislature as well for having approved it. I think this is an important document, and it's important because I believe that language shapes reality. And this document, this resolution, reflects the reality that we want to shape as a county. And so I think that that is important. I think it's also important because it also is reflective of the many, it is the antithesis, I should say, of the wordlessness and the silencing that has so often been the reality of Black voices in this society, which still happens today. So words indeed are important. It's also important to me at a personal level as well, because had certain things in my life taken a certain turn, I would not be here to share this with you today. I looked down the barrel of a Smith & Wesson gun in 1974 as a 17-year-old as police frisked me and a friend down and who were looking for someone who had robbed a store while we were waiting at a bus stop. And the police let us go as the bus came to the bus stop. Had that outcome worked out differently, I may not have been here to be with you today. So I say that simply to say that what we did today is important. It is not the end all or the be all, but it is an important first step. But also I am cognizant, too, that words have to be joined to actions. And what I'd like to share with you are some actions that the Office of Human Rights, in consultation and in coordination with the Human Rights Commission, will take over the next several months through our programming. I'll say, too, that while I know that educational programming and getting information to people does not cure all of the ills of racism, which are ultimately systemic and institutional, programming and education and awareness have to be joined by policy, by legislation, by change of hearts, and by, in many ways, a reimagining and a reconstruction of the society in which we're living to create the society in which comes closer to that more perfect union that President Obama spoke of often during his presidency and his run for the presidency. On Friday, June 5th at 11, OHR will be co-sponsoring with Ithaca College's Honors Program, a rapid response program on COVID-19, Black people, racist rhetoric, and violence. It will be a panel discussion which will include Dr. Christopher House, Associate Professor of Communication Studies, Travis Brooks, the Deputy Director of GIAC, Professor Nicole Horsey of the Center for Culture, Race, and Ethnicity, NIC, and myself. I sent out a notice about this event to a broad spectrum of folks today, the Human Services listserv, legislators, the commissioners, and others, in order to promote the program and encourage you to promote this program as well with your own contacts, constituencies, and others. So that will be from 11 to noon on Friday. In the future, at dates that we will specify, we also plan to engage in some other activities as well. One of them would be a community forum for Black men. And I will be talking with a number of Black men in our community in terms of what the shape and scope of that program can be, given the realities that so often Black men have been the targets of deadly encounters with law enforcement. We certainly know that Breonna Taylor and Sandra Bland and many others have also been those targets as well. And we are not highlighting one at the expense of the other. But we are, you know, going to create a forum for Black men as well, you know, at a date to be determined. Another piece of this in relation, as we couple the chasm that has unfortunately existed between law enforcement and communities of color, we also have to look at adjoining conditions that also affect the lives of Black people and other persons, and they really, in many ways, cut across all ethnicities. One of the programs we want to do is related to what I'm calling right now rent resumption versus rent cancellation, a conversation on perspectives on this issue from persons who are organizing around rent cancellation, with a landlord, with representatives from housing organizations such as CNY Fair Housing and Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services. As part of our plan this year, our programming plan this year, we had planned to do a quarterly film series. We had an initial showing of a film series of a film called Capturing the Flag on February 28th, just before the county closed down, and we want to continue that emphasis with a program, the showing of a film called America Divided, A House Divided. It's a documentary on housing and gentrification. We have know very well about the stories beginning in Ithaca, but also in other communities across the country in which we find African American and Latinx persons moving out of neighborhoods that have long been a part of their experience into other places as rents and mortgages, you know, rise to exorbitant prices. I watched this happen in San Francisco over 30 years ago as an assistant pastor when the Black population there was 13%. Now it is 5% out of nearly 900,000 people. And one of the reasons that exists is because of gentrification and the explosive rise of rents and mortgages. And so we want to show a film that really kind of tries to dissect that reality. We also eventually also want to have a program featuring members of the law enforcement community that is focused on accountability, police, community policing models and bridging the gap between law enforcement and black and brown communities. It will be a program in which we will be inviting Mayor Myrick to participate in. In a broad sense, what we want to do also in working with the Human Rights Commission is to develop a communications plan to promote to the public the role of OHR in the New York State Division of Human Rights, particularly in this time and in this moment, in which we find, because of the pandemic, for example, that many people, what we found, for instance, we rising instances of discrimination against Asian and Asian Americans. We found issues and sometimes unfair treatment in relation to housing. Certainly racism, which is not lost on us, and other factors. And we need to strengthen our message to the community that OHR is a resource to address these issues. So that, in a nutshell, is some of what we plan to do and that I will be doing, that I'll be talking with the commission about when we meet by Zoom next week. And we'll sort of chart our trajectory for certainly a good portion, if not the remainder of this year. So I yield the floor now to Gladys Brangman, who's the chair of our Human Rights Commission.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. Gladys, anything you want to add? Glad that you can join us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Actually, first I want to say thank you for drafting the resolution. I passed it on to the commissioners, and within 5 minutes, they were responding. We have a group of commissioners that are eager to be a part of this, are eager to be a part of whatever solution we're going to work towards. So we are going to promote awareness and understanding and constructive dialogue. I know many, many people who are just so eager to move forward and actually do something that matters. So I think I'm really just here to say thank you very much for the resolution. As we speak right now, the commissioners are working on drafting a statement. I am sure that by next week, we will have a statement that will either be in conjunction with this, perhaps with some additional information, just so that we can move forward and do exactly what you appointed us to do. So thank you.
Thank you, Gladys. Good to see you.
Good to be seen.
Sheriff, thank you for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, thanks, Leslin, for having me, and thanks for the three that wrote that resolution. Rich was kind enough to share it with me yesterday, and I did read it over. I didn't know who wrote it, but now I do. I thought it was wonderfully written. You know, this is hard for me, too, and I'm probably going to stumble over my words a little bit because this isn't easy for any of us. You know, Ann mentioned that, you know, the resolution was just a small thing that you can do and things like that. And I kind of understand where she's coming from. You know, it took me over 3 days to write what I did, which was printed in Ithaca Voice today. And, you know, I still feel like it falls extremely short. It was just really difficult for me and in my profession to even put words to what I saw, and just like the rest of you. But, you know, I'm a strong believer in police culture. You know, it starts at the top. In the recent murder of Mr. Floyd, you know, that's a prime example of failed leadership. Somebody that's had multiple use of force complaints filed against him and still nothing was done. There's no reason he should have even been working. You know, and it's really disheartening to me. I campaigned on building a trusted and community relationship with all community members, and I feel I've worked really hard to implement that in the sheriff's office. And when I see something like that, you know, there's just no excuse for it. And it just makes me feel like any small steps we do take, you know, they get set back. And something that happens in Minnesota or wherever affects me, affects my department. And I can say I haven't talked to one police officer, deputy sheriff, or corrections officer that feels any differently than I do. It's a complete tragedy what happens, and I'm not proud of the fact when such evil as that permeates my profession and reverses any good that we have done. But, you know, I do want you and the community to know that, we're here with you. We're committed to keep doing what we have been doing, and we just simply have to find a way to work even harder. You know, and like Dr. Clark said, you know, tonight's resolution isn't merely words. You know, words do direct behavior, and that's the reason why we've been so hard at work implementing policies in our sheriff's office, whether it be interacting with transgender persons, investigating hate crimes, victim services. Just today, we put out a new policy first thing this morning, duty to intervene, which, you know, reminds law enforcement officers that, you know, you may not be committing the act, but if you're merely standing there and watching it happen, you're just as guilty as the person committing it, and it's not something we're going to tolerate at the sheriff's office, and law enforcement administrators across the nation shouldn't tolerate that either. We're committed to keeping up our training. As a lot of you know, we do report on our training every month at Public Safety. We've been doing a lot of fair and impartial policing. Our use of force training review, which we do, you know, a couple times a year, started a couple weeks ago. We do incorporate de-escalation techniques in everything we do. I don't know what else to say. I apologize on the behalf of law enforcement, for sure. It's embarrassing to me, and it's very frustrating. And I'm here with you, Dr. Clark and whoever else, and I'm committed to working with you any way I can. And please know that it's from the heart. And, again, I'm here if anybody has any questions or anything like that.
Thank you, Derek. I will say one thing that I do appreciate hearing, that there's been an immediate move on policy, that if you are just a bystander in uniform when something is going down, that you are just as much responsible. So thank you for that. I think it's something we're looking for, concrete things like that to happen. It's, you know, unfortunate that it took this long, and the killing of someone publicly for, you know, for these things to happen, but at least it is happening, and thank you for being active in putting that policy, you and the undersheriff, putting this policy in place. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you. Rich and Annie, you both had your hands up and wanted to wait until after Dr. Clark. Go ahead, Annie.
I just wanted to just quickly say that in regards to second what Leslie said about white people, I don't know if this is exactly what you said, but in my head, what's going on and what has been going on is white people started this, and we need to fix it. A lot of people have been referencing the root of this racism started 400 years ago when black people, Africans were kidnapped in Africa and brought here as slaves. But it happened before that. And there's many instances in history that you can look up. But what brought Americans to that point that we thought that was okay, you know, to satisfy our greed, to make more money, that we could take human beings and bring them here and treat them as animals. So we have a lot of work to do. And I just wanted to just say, if you haven't seen the video of the Seattle police officer who grabs his colleague's knee from a man's neck that they are arresting. It's a moving video that people were yelling and screaming at the top of their lungs for this officer to get his knee off of this protester's neck. And the fellow officer just grabbed his colleague's knee and yanked it off. And that's what we want to see, and that is what does go on most of the time. And we need people to, yes, yell and scream and do whatever you could do I would actually possibly be one of those people that would jump on an officer that was doing that. I have jumped on people who have assaulted other people before. Maybe not always the safest position to be in, but that's what I have done, and we all need to do a lot more. So, and thank you for the words of Gladys Cannon and the sheriff.
Thank you. Rich.
Thank you, Leslyn. And I understand, certainly we've talked about this quite a bit, but like everybody else, this has certainly grabbed my attention. And I did want to note, it's really good that we have had respectful protests in our community, and we have not experienced some of the difficulty and trouble that other communities have had in talking about this issue. And again, I don't want to go on too long, but I'd like to share a short story from my past that just keeps coming to my mind, which is I was out running. This was maybe 10 years ago, and it was in the winter. It wasn't raining or snowing, but it was cold. And I was running on the road, and I looked down a path, and I saw somebody lying on the ground. And I thought, you know, I have to admit, I thought, is this really my problem? I could just keep going, and I couldn't. But I thought, well, what do I do? And frankly, I was kind of scared. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know if this person might have a weapon or be angry or was dead, perhaps. So I waved to a car, and two women stopped, and I asked if they could call 911 and watch me as I walked back down this pathway. They did. And I approached this person, and I walked around to the other side, and I saw it was a man lying on the ground. He had a bottle. And I looked, and I could determine he was breathing. And I was like, well, what do I do? You know, I'm here. I have to do something, and I'm totally unequipped. And at that point, a police officer showed up and came up, and he obviously knew the guy. He woke him up, and he spoke to him, you know, in a very respectful way and said, come on, we got to get you up. We got to get you warm. You know, he knew his name, and I finished my run. That happens every day. That's community policing. And it was practical compassion. We need that in our community. You know, as in the article that Deborah Dawson read, and I recommend it, you know, the author notes there's 18,000 police agencies in our country and about 700,000 police officers. For most of them, you know, to protect and serve is a calling. It is what they do, and they believe in it totally, and they want to do it the best way they can do it. Unfortunately, we've had this really, really significant breakdown in trust. I'm glad we have had this resolution in front of us. Thank you to those who worked on it, and I fully support it. I think it's and I'm also heartened that it's very clear from the comments that this is a starting point. We have so much to do if we're going to make a difference here. We need to make sure we have a dialogue about what kind of policing we want in our community, and we should be identifying the concrete steps in order to get there. In that mix, I believe it's vitally important that the line police officers are heard as well, in that if we do want fundamental change, they have to be directly involved in that process. And I hope that happens, and happens fundamentally and soon, that we need to be careful, of course, to have as calm a dialogue as we can and a respectful dialogue, but it has to happen if we really want to make a difference. I'll stop talking now, but certainly lots more to come here. So, and one more time, thank you for doing the resolution.
Thank you, Rich. Anna Kellis, you get the last comment, and then we got to move on.
Thanks, Leslyn, and thanks, Leslyn, for your courage and your vulnerability and your passionate words. Gladys, for your work and your dedication. I know you have been doing this work, helping people communicate in peaceful way, our peacemaker. Thank you so much, and Ken, for your wisdom and your dedication to this. I just want to say, and I guess I'm speaking just to my white colleagues in the, you know, and community. I think that it's very easy to hear what is experienced by our Black and Brown brothers and sisters, and know, you know, that there are many perspectives in a larger conversation. I think what's really important right now is to just give space for the voices that are rarely heard, and the imbalance that exists, and the inequity that exists. And I would just urge all of us to continue to educate ourselves about how we talk about race. And you know, maybe we can start a book club right now as a legislature, because we are we've agreed to take on a mantle of leaders in the community. And so, you know, we've talked, several of us, about not paying lip service. So I would ask maybe if we could all do a book club. So You Want to Talk About Race is a great book to start with. And someone recommended it to me recently, and I'm reading it, and I'd love to invite you all to join me. There's another one called White Fragility, and I think that both of those are two great starting points. And I urge all of us to read them, please, please. I think that we can be better allies, but also we can be, as Shelley Michelle Nunn said to me recently, we need co-conspirators. And they were powerful words. Leslyn has been a powerful force. She has been an educator for me. And I would acknowledge, Leslyn, it is not your role or your job. And you have had such profound amounts of energy to continue on as a leader, despite the profound exhaustion that it must incur to continuously experience moments of white fragility, unconscious maybe, but still exists. It is uncomfortable to see our own white fragility, but it exists whether we would like it to or not. So, again, I would just urge all of us to be aware, to recognize it, not go into shame, because it's so easy to go into shame and defensiveness, and, you know, step up to that challenge of learning. So I just wanted to end with that, and thank you, everyone, for all of our time on this.
Thank you, Anna. And again, thanks everyone for taking time. And like Anna said, allowing space for all of us to feel whatever it is we're feeling and express whatever it is we're expressing as we try to figure out how to move forward. Not move on, but move forward, because this will stay with us and we need it in order to move forward. Vote. And I'd love to hear your voices, so we'll go with a roll call vote on the resolution.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Jake McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shona Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. That carries unanimously. Thank you, Gladys, for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Clark, for joining us. You don't have to stay for the rest of the meeting. You know, it's up to you. If you want to be tortured some more, you can. but enjoy your evening if you choose to leave. There, I see Monica Roth, and I saw someone else as well.
And I know they were waiting for a resolution that's on the consent agenda, I believe. Is it?
No.
No, it's not.
But you're planning.
Yeah, that's morning.
Planning. If it's okay with you all, I will take those resolutions up as well so that Monica and Amila, I see Amila, Bernie, don't have to hang around. We had the public hearing already, and they both shared information with us. So, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Resolutions G and H.
All right, I'd like to now move Resolution G, making negative determination of environmental significance in relation to resolution number blank of 2020, action continuation of and modification to Ag District Number 1, located on the east side of Cayuga Lake and encompassing the towns of Lansing, Groton, Dryden, Caroline, and parts of Danby and Ithaca, ID number 9314.
Seconded by Dan Klein. Any discussion? Thank you very much. All right, roll call vote.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grayneson?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
I don't know where she is.
Anna Kellis?
I'm right here. Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Moore?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Martha is there. Oh, there, she's at the top.
I said yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Clairborn?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously.
I don't know what my phone is doing.
It's almost nice to see Monica's cat.
Sorry. Thank you all.
Go ahead, Deborah. Resolution H?
Yeah, Resolution H. I move Resolution H, action on the continuation of to Ag District Number 1, located on the east side of Cayuga Lake and encompassing the towns of Lansing, Groton, Dryden, and parts of Danby and Ithaca, ID number 9313.
Thank you. May I have a second? Seconded by Mike Lane. Discussion? Monica, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to, thank you all for your prior discussion. It was very moving. Thank you.
Thank you, Monica.
Thank you, Monica and Mila and your team for all the work you've done on this update of the agricultural district. I know a lot of time and effort went into it.
Thank you.
Yes,
roll call vote.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Nick Grayneson?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Moore?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Clairborn?
Yes. That carries unanimously. Thank you all. Look, did I miss something?
I forgot to announce the
vote. Okay. It's all right. Mila and Monica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Sticking around throughout all of it. Thank you for your patience.
Well,
no patience required. It was moving and beautiful, and thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't that just G? We have to do H too?
We did. We just did H, Martha. You voted yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mila and Monica.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Okay. Take care.
Sorry about that.
Anyone else waiting for any other resolutions?
my call. Consent agenda.
Pardon?
The consent agenda.
Right.
My call.
Yeah. My call, I see you. We'll go back to consent agenda. Facilities and infrastructure. Well, why not just take the consent agenda? Is that okay with you all? Yes. All right. So consent agenda, resolutions, and appointments to be voted on as a group, unless any member of the legislature requested a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually. Advisory board appointment, public safety committee to the ABIR, the advisory board on incident representation, we have Anna Callis, term expiring December 31 of 2021. And to the Traffic Safety Committee, Mike Sigler. Where did he go there? Okay.
What is?
Term expires December 31, 2020. And Glenn Morey, term expiring December 31, 2022. So you're both appointed to the Traffic Safety Committee and Anna to ABIR. And the rest of the consent agenda, Public Safety Committee, authorization to accept donation and budget adjustment for the Sheriff's Office. That's Resolution A. Resolution B, resolution calling on New York State Board of Parole to remove parolees from the Tompkins County Jail being held on technical violations. Okay. Under Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Resolution C, authorizing supplemental agreement number 24 with C&S companies for shared use fuel facility construction phase services, Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport, ID 9334. Resolution D, authorization to execute an agreement, General Aviation Customs Facility, Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport, ID 9335. Resolution E, authorizing award of bid and anticipated receipt of acceptance of FAA grant for the purchase of one aircraft rescue firefighting vehicle. Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport, ID 9338. And Resolution F, authorizing acceptance of an anticipated Federal Aviation Administration FAA grant, Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security CARES Act for opening operating costs and debt service, Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport, ID 9344. May I have someone move the consent agenda? Moved by Glenn Morey. May I have a second? Seconded by Dave McKenna. Thank you very much. Vote.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Callis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Arthur Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. Consent agenda carries unanimously. Thank you for hanging in there, Mike. You're free. Go home and enjoy your dinner. Save some for me. Back to the order of our agenda. County Administrator Jason Molino, County Attorney, Finance Director. Jason, thank you for joining us. Report.
Thank you.
We're not taking gloom and doom. We've had enough of that.
I have better news to report. Thank you very much, Leslin. And I would I have a brief COVID-19 report and just some reopening updates. Before I do, I just would like to say a few words and just offer that you know, in light of the conversation you've had this evening, you know, our colleagues and I have had, and I say colleagues meaning our colleagues in the county, and I have had a very close relationship over the past few months, more than I think we ever expected, which have allowed us to have a lot of discussions about a lot of things, particularly over the past week, and it's been a comfortable environment and an open environment to have those dialogues. And I think a big part of that is because of the leadership this legislature has created in terms of its culture with what is expected and what is allowed in our organization due to your diversity and inclusion policies and expectations moving forward, as well as in the past. And that's largely part of the culture that you've set and the leadership that you've established as a legislature. You know, we've had a lot of conversation over the past few days in talking about how we will continue, and I'll offer this as the leader of the organization, to continue to forward those policies to make sure that, you know, we make the changes to the systems that we have in our organization and an eye on what they should be and not focused on what they the way they are or the way they were in the past. And, you know, we'll continue to work as we have in the past and continue to work as we move forward to challenge the status quo when we need to and celebrate in that challenge. So I would just offer that as the county administrator as we go forward.
Thank you.
I can move into a little bit of an update on COVID, if you'd like, as well as some reopening. I'm going to share a screen if it's all right with everyone. You can all see that?
Yes.
So this is the similar format we've been able to use, and we consistently use at every legislature meeting, kind of giving updates about you know, where we are with things. This is just, again, a recap of some cases, executive orders. I will mention there has been quite a confusion over the past week and a half with the executive orders that have been issued at the state, by the state. They have been issued without much notification. They have been issued with no explanation or notification. And they have created some confusion that some of you may have been aware of from last week. There was the expectation of a phase two reopening on Friday. There was no comment in the governor's press conferences throughout the week. Direction from the control room and the staff was that we were to reopen on Friday. With a kind of reversal of that late Thursday by the governor, which created a lot of upheaval and confusion. We were fortunate that I was able to talk with our governor's rep at 4:45 on Thursday before we did our town hall, where he advised me that, hey, you know, we're not going to move forward on phase two right now with Friday. And we were able to get that message out. But it created a lot of frustration and challenges across the state. With regions that were slotted to move forward. Fortunately, Phil Rumsey, who is one of our state representatives, was able to call me because he knew we were going to have a town hall and really was able to relay the most frequent information. And unfortunately, he or some of the state reps in the regional control rooms aren't necessarily the first to know of some of these changes at the state level. Nonetheless, we were able, I think, to give out the right information at the time, which was important. The governor then on Friday later that day did move forward with phase two, but it created a little bit of confusion amongst everything else. I'm proud that from our perspective, from Tompkins County's perspective, we didn't do anything outlandish like some counties were doing, speaking out, contradicting the state, even though there were some frustrations. We were able to take it in stride. We communicated clearly. And you know, we were able to get through the challenges that took place on Thursday and Friday. Nonetheless, it was frustrating, and it continues to be frustrating because the executive orders are getting to the point now where they're amending ones that were amended, that amended, that amended, that amended. So we're down 5 or 6 deep, and they're pulling pieces from the prior ones without all of them. So it's like reading War and Peace, but we're doing the best we can with it. Nonetheless, we will progress through it. There's a new dashboard now. That was all news to us. Frank is going to go through that new dashboard and how it relates to the movement of phases. We are adopting the policy that we are not announcing or even suggesting a phase three until we have clarity and guidance. And I want to say written in stone that it will be moving forward so we don't get in the same communication challenges of the past. But as we were going through this, we tried to keep the legislature up to date as well as our economic development partners and community partners so that they could pass on the right information. So nonetheless, county operations, legislature approved a Rionics machine. I believe we've processed, and I do not know, but I don't know if the machine's been delivered or not, but I know it was in route or at least in process, which is good. Doesn't have to go very far, which is good as well. Mask and health screening directives were issued to county employees. We are going to put some new directives out tomorrow as we've received some changing information from the state, which is part of what I alluded for earlier with the change in executive orders. But we will communicate this to the employees and the workforce clearly, and we'll also support that to you so you're aware of it as well. We continue pushing mental health services, continue our substance abuse mental health services and service providers. So we want to continue to push the availability of our mental health services, and we will continue to do so weekly to ensure that folks know they have services available to them as everyone deals with different challenges over the past few months. And we are working with our Board of Elections to ensure all polling places are safe. We identified two locations last week that were near elderly facilities. So we were able to move them, and we're going to work with the Google Board of Elections to make sure that all polling sites are not putting anybody at risk, as we have hundreds, if not thousands, of people visiting them. And our reconstitution constitution operation plans have been submitted and approved to be slow in terms of reopening our county facilities. But a good effort by the staff. I want to compliment the department heads and our planning team again, doing great work. Trying to figure out how we also reopen operations in a new setting. Continue with our virtual town halls every Thursday. They are a hit. I do want to say that we expect to have less people viewing this Thursday only because Jay Franklin will not be present. He seems to be the closer. He pulls in the attraction. Everybody wants to see the county assessor. I'm surprised they haven't taken any shots at him yet, but he has a personal conflict and cannot attend on Thursday, so unfortunately our ratings may go down, but we'll try and bring him back next week. Gatherings under 10 people, and then also a variety of other, Dominic, I want to give a shout out to Dominic Recchio and our PIOs. They're doing a great job working with our local media, who's also been phenomenal in getting good stories out, getting good information out. They're working really difficult in a difficult environment with a constantly changing information. They're just doing a really good job. They deserve a good pat on the back. COVID hours and costs, we're going to continue to do this. Again, I draw your attention to the number of hours. The only thing that's reimbursable in that first line is OT, although there are probably some regular hours that can be reimbursed. So people that have been completely reassigned to the event in this sense, the response, we feel there may be an opportunity to get that reimbursed. Still working with FEMA. FEMA is just starting to get ramped up, and we have someone assigned to us now, so we're starting to ask some good questions. So we'll know more about that, and we're going to work on a submittal, one of our first submittals for FEMA reimbursement in the next few weeks, and we'll see how that goes. Estimated emergency leave. This is emergency leave use. We're going to probably continue to see this to decline, although it will continue for a little bit longer. That's one of the new directives that we have to send out to the staff and how to balance emergency leave in the upcoming weeks with some of the changes in the executive orders. But you can see where it was at its peak, and you can see it's been declining since early April, and I'll expect that to decline until the state removes some requirements and directives in the upcoming weeks. And then costs-related, direct costs, this is going to continue to go up in the future weeks and months, particularly as we start to have to buy certain supplies to continue to maintain a certain level of cleaning, certain other things. So this isn't going to dive off. This is going to continue to steadily go up. And like I said, we're going to start doing our first reimbursement in the next few weeks to see how that goes with FEMA. This is a new slide, and I think Frank is going to take this one. Frank, are you on?
Thanks, Jason. Yep, I'm here. And good evening, everyone. I wanted to share a little bit of information.
Hey, Frank, I think you need to turn the volume up a little bit. We can't really hear you that much.
Okay, let me get closer. Does that help?
A little bit.
Are we not on the mic?
You're not. I don't think you're on the right mic, buddy.
Hold on, give me 1 second. Okay, is that better?
Yes. It is good.
Yeah, about that. We were on the wrong microphone. We wanted to share this slide because it's a question that's been asked quite frequently, and it kind of demonstrates how we're beginning to transition from exposures to known cases being our primary source of disease transmission, where in May we finally saw a shift where the positive cases exceed the known exposure cases. So essentially what that tells us is the kind of the community spread conversation that we've been having. The one thing I would caution is, first, the numbers are still very low, and two, in May, we expanded significantly the number of asymptomatic people that are being tested, right? So the nursing home folks, essential workers, phase one, and now phase two workers. So there is an expectation when you're testing people just because of their profession, that the potential is you're going to find people that we might not have otherwise found through this when we were focused on individuals that were symptomatic. So I don't think we can draw conclusions that this is from reopening or anything like that. I really just wanted to make sure you all were aware that we are beginning to see that number transition from known exposures to community spread. You can go to the next one, Jason.
There you go.
And so this was the dashboard change that Jason spoke about. The original dashboard still exists with the 7 metrics that each region has to meet. And really the only thing that's new in this subset are those new infections in the middle, those two measures there. The first, the green two, used to actually be over in the other chart. Now those are just green check marks, and the data has been moved here. And the gray, the hospital capacity piece, are just brought over from the other chart as well. So the new infections is the part that's new, and really it was something that, you know, we talked a little bit about when we were reviewing the other dashboard, in that, you know, the measures were related to hospitalization, because that's really when you start to see the healthcare system, you know, struggle, right, if they get to a certain level. And I think there was a realization that there's a measure before that, and that measure is the disease prevalence. And I think this was a correction to make sure that that was now kind of brought forward. The one thing I don't know is kind of what the standard is for those new infection numbers, kind of what they're looking for. I think it's more just to make sure that was on people's radar as we were moving through this, understanding that we may have additional cases as we reopen, and we want to be monitoring that as we move forward. That's all I had, Jason.
Thanks, Frank. So here's just an update on FoodNet Meals on Wheels and meals since March. We've seen a little bit of dip in demand, but still higher than I think earlier, the earlier part of January, but still remarkable. School districts also are playing a huge role in being able to get food and meals out to families, and that complement them as well as we go, as they've transitioned quite a bit over the past several months. And I believe that's it.
Okay, thank you, Jason. Questions? I see Shauna, I see Henry, I see Anna. Shauna?
Hi. Yes, thanks, Jason and Frank. I think one thing that I want to make sure that my colleagues and the public are aware of, that you had mentioned the other day in one of our meetings, is that we entered into phase two, And, you know, I think there's been the lingo that in 14 days we're ready to move on to phase three. And I wonder if you could just clarify, because I think, you know, one of our meetings, maybe it was actually just this morning, seemed like it was weeks ago, but it was this morning. you had said that, you know, the 14 days, that might or might not happen, and that we really shouldn't grow attached to thinking that in 14 days we're ready to go to phase three.
Yeah. That's a good point. I know as long as we've talked about it, there has never been a clear statement made by the state, clear direction given. And I've always said when talking about this that it would make sense and it would seem reasonable that after 14 days of the metrics didn't change, we would move forward. And that was true partially also because of the representatives in the regional control room from the state also reaffirmed that. And you know what happened, and we can go through the last week's events over and over again. Essentially what happened is there was a lack of communication that the state wanted to review the metrics for some additional review and didn't really be forthcoming about that. And there might be reasons why that was the case, but at the end of the day, had that happened Wednesday or Thursday and clear statement was said as well, we're going to review it, it may not be Friday, I think everybody would have been like, all right, well, I get it now, you know. Not even knowing what the metrics were. That didn't happen, and it created, you know, in the void of information, it just, you know, people created things and made things up. So from our perspective, I think I've accepted the perspective that, you know, the 14 days is nice, but it's not guaranteed, and we're just not going to be talking about what phase three is until these additional review of metrics is going to take place. And they pretty much confirmed that after 14 days, they're going to start to review those metrics. There is no hard data that says if you hit this mark, you're ready to move forward, or if you hit this mark, you have to stay back or something on those. It's a fluid thing. It's going to be based on region. I did ask, I think, on Friday that, you know, they try to do a better job of getting the guidance out several days in advance for those phases, and that even if they're not going to move forward or they don't know, tell us they don't know. You know, I'd rather have that be told to me than not have anything. And, you know, to a certain extent, we were kind of watching the governor's press conferences, you know, and then just had this empty void when nothing was mentioned about it, and then no answer. So I think everybody's communicated the same. You know, the messengers on the calls have definitely understood our frustrations, and I think the message to the public here, at least in our county and our region, is that, you know, metrics will be reviewed. There is no fast rule as to when we're going to move to phase three. When we do, we will let you know. Assuming metrics don't change drastically, though, you know, it'll come closer in 2 weeks than later. But we're not going to – we're going to take the same position we have, and there is no set date.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for asking, and thanks for clarifying, Jason. Henry, Anna, and then Martha.
Yes, Jason. In terms of the school lunches or school feedings, meals, are they going to continue that during the summer?
I asked that question, and I don't think they have a great. They don't have an answer as of yet. I think it's something they're trying to work through and they're talking about. But I asked that question a little while about last week, and there wasn't a clear answer on it yet.
Okay, can I also ask a question about PPE? Have you been getting stuff from the state still?
We're getting some stuff and distributing it, although we are expecting to get less as things open up more. But when we do get it, we distribute it. You know, a lot of folks that have requested it, we are in constant communication with them to come and get it. So when we do get it, we distribute it. But the message we've been receiving also from the state is that this is probably going to get less frequent in terms of those supplies.
I'm also wondering, as you reopen, are you getting pushback from companies saying they don't have enough PPE?
You know, I don't know that we've had a huge amount. We've had some requests, and we're able to support some in their requests, but I don't know that we've had a huge pushback. I mean, frankly, it is what it is in terms of the requirements to reopen. You know, people that don't want to do it, I don't know that we've been getting a lot of that feedback. And you know, to be honest, we haven't had a huge amount of issues of non-compliance either, which is more than what I can say for some counties in my county, my colleagues across the state. So I think that whatever's happening, you know, the communication is going well. We're doing a lot of communication. I know our economic development partners, TCAD, the Chamber, the DIA, the City Economic Group, you know, they're doing a lot of education, and I think that's resonating, and we're trying to help people find solutions when they have problems or they're having obstacles.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Anna, Martha, Mike Sickler.
Thank you, Jason and Frank, for all of your continued work. Two questions. They're kind of hard questions, so I'm not, you know, it's no guarantee you'll have the answer, but I did want to bring them up. One of them, I've been contacted by constituents who have family members who are in the high-risk elderly population who have now been isolated for many months, and it's becoming more and more difficult for them to maintain their current support system, particularly in economic crises. They would like to be able to start taking care of them, but don't want to do it without getting tested to make sure that they aren't at risk. Is there any possibility at some point for people who are caregivers of elderly high-risk population to be eligible to get the testing, even if they don't have symptoms?
Yeah. If they're caregivers, I don't know if that constitutes as an essential worker, Frank, but you know, is that something you can weigh in on?
Yeah, no, currently they would not meet that criteria for testing. We are hopeful that testing is going, the criteria will continue to grow. It has, as each phase, you know, we move from essential workers to phase one and now phase two workers. You know, there is still the issue of capacity. You know, Cuyahoga Health Systems is building capacity quickly, but it takes time to get it online. And then there's also the question of reimbursement related to testing outside of non-established criteria. So we're efforting all of those things, and I can tell you that everyone on our end, including Cuyahoga Health Systems, wants to make testing as widely available as it can be. We just have to work through a few more issues to be sure that we're doing it the right way.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. I think I'd like to just put an earmark on that particular group, because I think they're very easy to fall through the cracks because they are informal caregivers, and in many cases they can't afford a formal caregiver, which would then make them safe because that formal caregiver would be an essential worker. So it's sort of they're in a rock and a hard place. So just putting a thumbnail on it for you and keeping that group in mind, that would be great. And the other question I have for both of you as well, I've heard from three different healthcare workers now. Two of them have communicated that that are working specifically in nursing homes, that the swab test, which is quite invasive, can be multiple times per week. There are some people who have experienced some physical damage from that, having it so frequently as a requirement by the state. I know it is Cuomo's requirement. I'm not saying it's ours. There are also healthcare workers who have had physical trauma in their lives. I don't, you know, it's obviously not our place to question what re-traumatizes them. But there are several people who are in the healthcare arena in nursing homes who have come forward, at least to me, to communicate. We have discussed in the past the possibility of a new test being a mouth swab. I want to know where that is, if that's possible, if the state is aware of it, if they are moving forward with that potentially being an alternate, or is that just for antibody tests? You know, if that, I guess, also, Jason, could be a message that's brought up the ladder, that we would like to see alternatives for and reconsideration from the nursing home aides, that would be great.
Frank, maybe you should explain the two different testing, the nasal flagellate and the oral flagellate, and maybe just go through with the differences between the two, which are the two that I know of are approved. And I guess I would just say that, you know, we've had similar questions about the frequency of the testing and the challenges it poses. But Frank, maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I've almost got Jason trained. It's oral pharyngeal and nasal pharyngeal. He's getting closer. the testing, those are the two main ways. So the nasal pharyngeal is the one that goes deep in the nose. Oral pharyngeal takes something from the back of the throat and then the inside of the nasal cavity. And those are the two methods that are being used currently. As far as the saliva test, it is not yet widely available and or has it been determined how sensitive it is related to testing. So I know that they are working to develop those tests, but we want to make sure that when we begin using them, we can rely on the results that come from them. As far as the nursing home staff, yeah, I've had the same conversations probably tenfold, Anna, with folks about, doing it twice a week. And, you know, there is some consternation about why twice a week and what does that mean? I hear that and I get all of the concern, but on the flip side of it, people are dying in nursing homes from COVID-19 in significant numbers across New York State. Every day the governor reports and at least a third of the deaths are still in nursing homes. And while I certainly sympathize, I don't have to get tested twice a week. So, you know, I'm not dealing directly with it. So I certainly empathize with the folks that are. It is, in my opinion, a small price to pay to protect the most vulnerable people amongst us if it gives us more information about potentially keeping COVID-19 out of nursing homes. So I get it. I get the concern, and I get the challenges that faces on those workers who, quite frankly, were already overworked and overstressed before COVID-19. It's just another burden on them. But I don't know what's too much when we're talking about protecting the most vulnerable amongst us from a disease that is targeting them.
Right. I think the point that I also would like to make is that there's no epidemiological analysis or results showing the frequency that is appropriate. So, you know, if you can just keep us informed, that would be great.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Frank. Martha, Annie? Martha, then Mike Stigler.
Thank you. A couple of maybe quick questions. I've been in a couple of stores, and it seems like people in stores are really, there's a lot of compliance, almost everybody with a mask on, but not out on trails and walks. I don't know if that's your general experience or observation, Jason and Frank.
Yeah, I mean, again, correct me if I'm wrong, Frank, but if you cannot maintain if you cannot maintain the 6-foot distance, a mask is required. If you're out for a walk and you can maintain the 6-foot distance, it's not required. I think the education that we've used is have a mask with you, have it accessible, and you should be prepared to don that mask unless you can guarantee that you'll never have that issue. So I think that's partly the message, the question. And Frank, is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, Jason. And I think one of the challenges that we face with this, using your two examples, Martha, in a store, the store operator has a role in enforcing and making sure that masks are being worn.
Right.
On a trail, we're all kind of left to our own devices to figure that out. So there is a difference in that. And, I think people are trying, and, you know, I've heard about particular stores that people aren't wearing masks. And then I went into those stores myself and saw 100% compliance. So some of it has to do with moment in time of what we're experiencing as well. So it is challenging. And I think our message is still, you know, please help us, right? Help us have a mask with you in case you can't be 6 foot away, whatever the setting might be.
Right. I see a generational difference. Old folks like me have the tend to have the masks on the trails, but not younger. I thought about nursing home residents. I thought when the guidance came out about nursing home staff, I thought there was also a requirement for residents to be tested. I can't remember if that's right.
There is not a mandate for nursing home residents to be tested. We were working to try to get them all tested before the mandate came for staff, and that kind of overshadowed that previous work that we were doing. I am happy to report that I believe all but one of our local nursing homes has tested all of their clients, their residents, and the one that hasn't is scheduled for later this week.
Okay, and if they found somebody positive, or they, I hope they're moved out, I mean, found another place to...
Yeah, there are processes in place that the facility has to follow if they're going to maintain the person in their facility. And if they're unable to do that, the state will work to relocate the individuals.
And how long, and how often are corrections officers tested?
Correction officers aren't tested unless they have, unless they're symptomatic, or unless they've been in contact with a positive case or a positive person, or unless they've been subject to a public health directive and then may have been exposed. So they're not required to be tested. They do healthcare. They have been doing health. They're probably the first group of employees to be health to do healthcare screening since the beginning of May or March. I'm sorry, beginning of March.
It seems like an interesting. With nursing home staff, which I understand residents of a nursing home are typically more vulnerable than the average prison or jail population, but it seems like maybe there ought to be some attention on that as well. I mean, because as you've said a thousand times, people have it and the temperature won't show it and there won't be any symptoms, et cetera. So. I don't know if that's something that's been discussed in the control room.
It hasn't been discussed in the control room. I mean, I can say that, you know, knock on wood, jail infections have been relatively small in New York State. They have not been huge in terms of or significant in terms of single population impact. So, you know, that would probably most likely have to be a directive from the Commissioner of Corrections.
Okay.
And, you know, I know our jail has been diligent from the beginning and probably was one of the first institute, at least healthcare screening early on. And they continue to push, you know, if you're sick, don't come to work. I know it doesn't necessarily drop the asymptomatic folks, but, you know, right now it seems to be working, and there is a concern about if the jail population does increase, is there going to be any directives around testing for any increases in the jail population? We just started to have that conversation. So right now, though, it seems to be working well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Jason. Mike Sickler.
Hi, Jason. I'm sorry if I missed this, but with the day camps allowed to reopen now, are we in conversation with Tompkins Youth Services about any of that, or what's your position?
I forwarded the notification to Kate Shanks Booth. I've not touched base with her on it yet. You know, guidance is not out yet, and they say they're allowing, you know, summer rec programs to start June 29th, I think. I would imagine this week, as it's probably already started, there's going to be some discussion as to whether or not certain, you know, organizations are going to do, you know, rec programs, if they've had enough time to ramp up or not. There's a lot of nuances to it, the background checks, so on and so forth. So this was an interesting. We've been asking this question for 3-4 weeks now. It got one line, one sentence in the press conference, and then moved to something else. It was almost as if there was an intention to not mention anything about it, but very, I mean, it was, you know, we all looked at each other as we were watching, say, did that just really happen? So we have to wait for guidance on this, and Kate Shanks Booth, our director, was given, I sent her the notification of it, and I'm sure we'll have the conversations we'll pursue on it. Yeah.
I also talked to Liz Vance at Ithaca Youth Bureau, and she said financially they can't handle anything this summer.
But there's a lot that, you know, goes into it. You know, Jason is right. I mean, just like the phase two reopening, and then there was no guidance, and everybody thought, well, let's open and do it. All it was just an announcement. And it can happen, but you still have to wait to see what, you know, goes into making that happen. And for a lot of organizations, I'm not sure that it'll be possible for them to do it this summer.
I mean, one thing to think about.
For many of us who have employees on furlough or employees laid off, any number of things, I'm not sure. So, yes, there's a lot more to consider. Who am I missing? Annie.
Thank you. I just want to address again the issue that Anna Kellis brought up as far as the manner of the testing. And so, I mean, I could go on and on about statistics, so please feel free to look up statistics of men and women who have been raped, victims of child sexual abuse. Again, I won't go on and on about that. But for me, falling in two of those many groups, being a survivor, that was traumatic for me to go get tested. It was traumatic. I actually had an out-of-body experience. I mean, my body could not, my mind could not physically be there in my body while that was happening. I was told, and so I was told that they swab one nasal passage. Well, they did it, I didn't realize it was going to be for 10 seconds. So that was hard enough. Got done, I steeled myself, because, okay, it needs to be done. And then they said, we're going to do the other passage. And then they did the mouth. And so I'm just asking if minimally, if we can have a video about that and step by step, because I didn't know, I wasn't prepared, and that was really hard. So please.
Thank you, Annie. We hear you. I really do want to appreciate everybody's patience and time. We've got a lot. We also have an executive session, and we'll talk with Jason. I'm sure we'll mention that, and we'll say why. But at this point, we're just going to take a break. Get something to eat, something to drink, and we'll be back here at 8 o'clock. I'm sorry it's short this time. Okay, I think we have a quorum. All right, we are going to resume our meeting, and please forgive me, but I'm going to be trying to eat something, too. It's not cute when you're in these little boxes, but I have to eat. Jason, thank you. We're going to continue. Annie, thank you for sharing that little bit. We left off with you sharing how traumatic the experience was around testing and just sort of educating people about what to expect. So thank you for that and for bringing that up. Mr. Molino, you may continue.
I don't think I had anything else to update the legislature, Leslin.
Okay.
We continue to, obviously, day to day, I will tell you my time. I'm spending, some more time doing my normal job, which is county administrator work, managing the day-to-day stuff. But it ebbs and flows, and at any point in time, it can change. I know Amy is still very much engaged and fully involved up at the EOC, as is Frank, Jay Franklin still. So we are trying to, monitor that and see as time goes if we begin to have less time there or less time on COVID response, but we'll see what happens, and we'll go with it. I did give directions. I think I sent that to the legislature, to staff, to start doing their budget input, which is around this time. Before COVID, we had agreed to start a week earlier. We decided to stay with that schedule for a variety of reasons. So they'll continue. They'll begin to draft their budgets and put them into the budget system this month, and then we'll start with our formal reviews in July. But outside of that, that's really what I have to update, unless there are any further questions. I do have a joke I'd like to share with everyone, if that's all right.
I see Henry and Martha's hands up, but I also want to, Jason, are you still in need of an executive session?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. To talk about contractual negotiations. Yes, I appreciate it.
Okay. So, again, I appreciate everybody's patience, but we will have an executive session tonight to talk about bargaining unit negotiations. Henry?
Oh,
Sure. Jason, any word from what the governor is going to do with his budget?
I don't, but I think right now, I think the governor is going to wait until what happens at the federal level. And I think that is a strategy because any proactive effort he makes to reduce state expenses, I think he views as may count against them by the feds in terms of reduced aid. I think it's a very challenging decision and a risky one, but I think that's what's going to happen. So I suspect, you know, everything we've heard, although that was last week, because before really last week took place, we heard that, you know, the feds would probably be taking this issue up in the next 2 weeks. We'll see if that happens. And if something is adopted, then I think we'll see something afterwards. If it's not, then that's when I think we'll see something. So otherwise, I have no inclination. I know the highway superintendents in the state did send another letter to the our communication to the governor urging the release of CHIPS funding. But other than that, I don't know of anything new that's developed on that front.
Do you think he'd also try to do a one-for-one in terms of if we get stuff from the feds, then he would deduct it from us?
That's definitely a possibility. You know, in the last stimulus package, I think in 2008 or 9, the federal government passed. There was definitely a bait and switch kind of a attempt with respect to the state using those funds to either offset their own programs, offset their own projects, or move money around. And very little was passed down or benefited to the local municipality. So anything's up for game. You know, our state delegation worked hard with the first series of the CARES Act to ensure that we get some EFMAP funding, which, again, we have not yet seen but are supposed to. I can tell you the state is having cash flow problems, so every week there are some nuances to cash flow that changes to the state's typical functions, whether before a few weeks ago it was workforce development funding, the other day or earlier this week or last week it was some different DSS payments. So there is definitely some games happening with the state's cash flow, which is either causing them to delay payments or, you know, where they're usually promptly at certain times, there seem to be days behind or a week or two behind. And then, so those things are going on, and I think that's obvious just because the state's having cash flow problems.
Okay, and I wait to hear your joke.
All right, I'll tell you in a second.
All right, thank you, Henry. Thank you, Jason. Martha?
Well, I don't want to hold anybody up from hearing Jason's joke, but on the federal funding, we're hearing, I mean, Tom Reed keeps saying mid-June they'll pass something, but it's sure, if they're working on it behind the scenes, not much is leaking out in public. I would be, I'm actually interested, you said you briefly said that you reported to department heads and gave them guidance. If you could talk a little bit more about that, we shared the PowerPoint with us, but give more of a sense of what the plans are and how the departments are looking at it.
So in the few minute version of this, basically, you know, under normal sort of conditions, I would be giving guidance to the department heads based off of the target or the fiscal targets adopted by the legislature. For obvious reasons, we don't have that. So it creates a little bit of a challenge, but, you know, that in of itself is manageable. What creates the challenge is the significant uncertainty as to what's going to happen in the upcoming months for this year and then how that's going to relate to next year. It really has to do with what is going to be a post-COVID environment. How is that going to bless you? What's going to happen in, from a state revenue perspective? What's going to happen from an economic perspective? There just really is no guidance. There's no ability to predict, and there's no precedent to base it off of, right? So that's what's so challenging. And I'm balancing that with also, you know, giving direction to department heads. We start our process earlier for good reason. There's a good process we have. But the problem is that I don't want them to go through a frivolous exercise of creating multiple renditions of budgets that aren't going to be valuable. So the direction I gave is prepare two budgets, one a flat budget and one is a 12% decrease in local share budget. And I said very clearly, this is a starting point. It could go either way. It could go bad. It could go better. But this is a starting point. Not all departments will be impacted the same, and we need to get over that fact, you know, amongst themselves. But I need honest efforts as to how we're going to manage this. I also said that it's probably not practical. Assuming a revenue shortfall that we've estimated, it could be anywhere as small as a 20% decrease, just a 20% increase in the tax levy. I said, that's not a practical option for me to go to the legislature and bring you a 20% tax increase. So it is probably not a practical option to make up that 20% tax increase through complete expenditure reduction. So it's going to have to be a blending of both. And we have a starting point of a discussion. Same thing with supporting agencies. I asked a 12% decrease in the local funding and gave the same message. It could go up, it could go down. So really, you know, we talked about possibly pushing back the budget entry date, but even if we pushed it back a month of data right now isn't going to give us a whole lot of understanding right now, and that's just going to put us really far behind on our preparation process. So that's the direction we gave. I am meeting with departments. I made myself available, and they immediately, you know, contacted me about setting up and having some specific questions. I did challenge them. I said, if there are technology investments that can further support, you know, service delivery in different ways, I want to bring that forward. I want to have those discussions. I also told them that, you know, with 12% reduction in local share, that's not papers and pencils. That's positions. So the fact is that we are going to have a budget with less positions in it than we did this year is a reality. And they need to be thoughtful and innovative and really challenge the norm as to how they deliver service. And they need to look at programming, and they need to look at mission-critical programming. So the other thing I did say is I did not want OTRs that were just going to skirt the difficult decision process just to propose a workaround. I said, you know, that's not what's going to make this work. It's not what's going to be successful for you as a department and for me as an administrator. You know, we've prided ourselves over the past 2 years that when we bring a budget forward, I can support every element of it, and we want to continue to have that type of camaraderie and relationship with department heads as we go forward. So, you know, they've got a lot of work out of them, as do we, and we'll see. And as new information comes available, we'll know more in the next week. Rick will share some great news with us about sales tax, so we'll be able to see how we're faring there. That'll be our second month, really, in the midst of this to understand the impact, and we'll go from there.
I think that was probably your joke, right?
No, that was not the joke.
Okay. If I can ask about cash flow, I mean, frankly, I forgot about FMAP. I mean, but you know, it seems that, you know, Schumer's office has certainly assured us 10 ways to Sunday that we are going to get that enhanced Medicaid aid, but it's still not showing up. How are we, and how do you think we will go through the rest of the year as far as cash flow when we eventually get these kinds of pockets, you know, buckets of money, but we don't know when? So even if something's approved at the federal level, it might take a while to get it.
I'll let Rick talk about this as well, but I'll say generally, from a cash perspective, the county is in a good position. You know, you're fiscally healthy, and we can withstand some of these types of constraints and revenue constraints. So I don't think cash flow is a problem with us. And keep in mind too, the EFMAP funding, I doubt that would be in form of a check. It would probably be in form of reduced Medicaid payments. So from a straight cash flow perspective, I can't see that really helping us. But I don't feel, and I think Rick would agree, I don't feel that we have cash flow constraints to the extent that we would be coming to you asking for a revenue or a tax anticipation note to borrow cash to make payroll, right? So we're not at that point, and I don't see us being at that point anywhere in the near future. Would you agree, Rick?
Exactly. We really haven't experienced any cash flow differences from any other year yet.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Jason. Any other questions for Jason? All right.
What about his big joke?
A joke. I'll make it quick, Leslie. Is that all right?
No, you are not a good stand-up comedian, so no. We already had your joke. Martha already named it. Jonathan, do you have anything for us?
No, I'm going back to the traditional no report.
Okay, that was the joke. All right, Jason, go ahead.
All right.
What's the joke?
Jonathan got a haircut, so that's not the joke either. Thursday, we're in this regional control room at 7:30. Everybody is heated. You can hear the tension on the phone because no one knows what's going on with phase two reopening, right? You got county administrators, executives on the call. Everybody is just upset. It's 7:30 at night, and that's when they call the meeting. It's supposed to be at 1:30 in the afternoon.
What?
And the regional reps are late to get on the call. It's 1 minute goes by, 2 minutes go by, 3 minutes go by. So I said, I go off the unit, I says, I'm going to tell a joke. So here's my joke. So up in Trumansburg, we have a healthy carpenter bee population. I don't know if you do anyplace else in the county, but we have a lot of carpenter bees, right? But my youngest daughter, Charlie, was playing outside during one of the days last week. It was nice. And she came inside and said, Mama, you know, there was a few carpenter bees out there on the deck. But you know what? I stayed away from them. And she looks at her, she says, Mama, I was practicing good social distancing. 6 years old. No, 7 years old. Anyway, that's my joke. I'm done.
It sounds like a really good commercial for social distancing. You might have something on your hand there. Let me know if you need a talent agent.
All right, I'll let you.
Well, that's wonderful. We needed that. We needed that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much. Rick, do you have anything else for us? Please tell me that you have a joke.
I don't have a joke. Well, I do have jokes, but I won't say them here tonight. I'll have to look through them before I come back with those. But we don't have sales tax figures yet. Anything new since the last time we met. But by next meeting, we should have some preliminary figures for you for the month of May. I do have some good news after still being behind in the audit. We are about at that place to where we're about to submit our AUD to the state tomorrow. Drew and I are next door to the legislative building working late tonight as we did this weekend. All weekend and even last weekend, Memorial Day weekend. So we're still behind schedule, but we have rough preliminary figures for how well we did in the general fund last year and how well we did all the funds, really. So we'll be transmitting the state report tomorrow. The auditors will be extending their audit probably for another month. The good news is that the total fund balance for the general fund looks like it's up $4.6 million. So that should be encouraging if you're looking for some ray of hope and a little bit of good news. That should give you something to go home with tonight that will help us in the current disastrous situation we in, that we have a very positive 2019 fiscal year to report to you. We did bring our staff back this week 100%. Finance has been open through the whole crisis, and we worked at 50% alternating employees at work at home compared to work at the office. We are taking all the safety precautions with our masks and very diligent with wiping down areas. The building has been locked. As you know, for a long time, we are still locked. So when we say we're open, the building is locked, and we are seeing customers by appointment only. We'll be continuing that for the next 2 weeks until around the 16th when Jason and the committee that works in this building meets again to see how we're going to move forward after June 16th. But all employees are back in finance. Everyone's doing well. And the only thing that's really brand new that I think is encouraging has worked out well the last week or so is we have a new lockbox that's outside the main entrance of the old jail building for people to drop payments. And so that has become used immediately and is working out wonderfully. And between that and mail-in payments and internet payments, we have been able to conduct business very positively and effectually for our customers.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome.
Any questions for Rick? Thank you for the good news. We needed that.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's go on with the rest of our agenda very quickly. See how we can get through. We did consent already. Government operations, Amanda. Standing committee reports and resolutions. Amanda, you're up.
I'm up. Government operations is meeting on this Thursday at 1:45 here on Zoom. We have a couple of important things that we're going to be talking about. Planning and sustainability is going to give us the update on the foreclosure recommendations. Board of Elections will be there to give us a brief update on the upcoming election, but also Shauna had sent out an email earlier today about changing in poll locations. So they will be there to answer questions further about that and clarify if needed. We're going to be looking at a big, long policy, policy 2-44 about reasonable accommodations. And we will also be looking at a resolution which is related to the census and the redistricting process that we talked extensively about at our last meeting. The resolution that's coming forward was written by Jonathan, our county attorney, and it is what it would do would be to direct the process to be a change our terms to 2-year terms and then going back to 4-year terms. So that was one of the options that GEO had settled on. So that will be discussed further and voted on. And again, that's Thursday at 1:45. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Questions for Amanda? Thursday, June 4th, 1:45 GEO meeting. Lots of stuff to discuss, important stuff. Annie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amanda, I was wondering if there was something on term limits. I had seen something in an email referencing that.
Well, that's the resolution I was just talking about, the one that's related to redistricting and term, not term limits, but our term length.
Okay. I thought there were term limits, just term lengths. Okay.
Yeah, it's not term limits. So if that's the wording that someone's using, that's incorrect. It's our election cycle coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Amanda? All right. Thank you very much. Deborah, any report? We took care of your resolutions. Any report?
Yes, we just heard from the Water Resources Council. They gave their annual report, and several members came, and we discussed various water issues that continue to impact our lake and our watershed. We're looking forward to, at some point, being able to work on some meatier environmental issues, but what with COVID and everything else, we're just kind of keeping it lean and mean.
All right. Any questions for Deborah? Thank you, Deborah. Okay, moving on. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. We haven't met since the last legislature meeting. We do meet next Monday, June 8th. And Jason's going to hog the whole agenda, really. So it'll be mostly about the retirement program, the policy changes that we're looking at, retirement incentive, and changes to proposed changes to retiree health insurance. JC, think we'll have material on a resolution tomorrow, or when would we have that?
I'm going to say Thursday at the latest. Okay. Lisa and I met today. There was some fine-tuning left with it, but so I said if we need to take another day, I'm okay with that. But Thursday at the latest, you'll have it. We'll add that to the agenda. We'll make sure you're all aware of it. and we'll send it to you as well as the workforce so they can take a look at it.
Okay. So that will be it. So committee members, look for that on Thursday, because it probably will be some sort of heavy reading.
Yeah, it's complex, and that's part of what's taking a little bit longer is explaining it in a non-complex way.
Right.
That makes any sense. But it's really difficult to get through. It's all connected, and we're trying to get through it. It's multiple renditions. So Lisa's done a great job working on it. Sarah Thomas has weighed in on it. The staff has provided input. So it's a good – I think it's something you'll like. I think I'm hopeful it's something that you'll support. I think it'll provide opportunity for us as well as for our staff and our future retirees. So I think it's fair and balanced and reasonable. It's just understanding it is tough. So I think it'll take all the meeting.
Well, we'll look forward to doing that. And everybody, set aside time to read that material after Thursday. Thanks very much, Jason. That's all I have, Leslyn.
Once again, Martha, when is the meeting? Monday at
in the afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Okay. June 8th, 3 p.m. All our committees are doing some heavy lifting. Amanda's got heavy stuff this week. Budget has heavy stuff on Monday. And Kathy is sliding lower and lower in her chair over here. Like, oh, no. All right. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee report. Annie, thank you for the resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for everybody who supported that. Well, thank you, everybody. So the couple of things, I'll just go on the highlights of our last meeting, which was just last week on the 27th, regarding plans for LGBTQ plus month. Typically, our Office of Human Rights does some activities, but I'm not sure if they're going to be able to do anything because it's pretty limited. And Ken was just trying to get up to speed with using Zoom to host activities. So it's pretty limited. But we are, through Finger Lakes Pulse, we are hearing some other groups around the county might be doing some activities. So we'll share those when we hear about those. And so a good portion of our discussion was, of course, on the death of George Floyd, and in addition, the disproportionate effects of the virus on the African American, people of color, Asian communities. And next meeting, we're hoping Dr. Clark was trying to schedule the Ithaca Asian group to discuss the various discrimination that they have faced and are continuing to face, and the discrimination of various actions against their community and individuals due to racism along with the virus, unfortunately. So he's trying to get them for our next meeting to come and talk to us. So that is Wednesday, the 24th of June at 3:30, if anybody would like to tune in. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. The Chair of Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, and I want to offer a little bit of homework to my colleagues and anybody else who's watching us, as this is Pride Month. A lot of people are well familiar with the Stonewall Inn demonstration and see that as what triggered sort of the movement for LGBTQ plus rights in this country. There's lots of movements that are happening before Stonewall Inn from as early as the 1950s. And so I want to encourage people to read some more about the, you know, the Mattachine or the Daughters of Violetus and all of the work that they were doing prior to Stonewall, you know, for the rights of people who are LGBTQ plus. So just a little bit of homework as we all try to educate ourselves on these matters of human rights. So thank you. And I'll be quizzing you next month, so I'm kidding. Tompkins County Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Leslin. The Tiger Committee has not met since the last legislature meeting, but we do meet tomorrow at 11:30, and we have a pretty full agenda. We are, as before, we're going to hear from Diane Miller and Charlie Krasanski, the public affairs people from Cornell. And one of the main topics we expect to hear from them about is the Federal Transportation Trust Fund reauthorization. This is the major federal highway funding bill that will expire on September 30th. And they're, among everything else, they're, the Senate and House are working on that. And related to it, Scott Vanderpool from TCAT is going to join us for the meeting. So that should be a good conversation. We're also going to hear from Natalie Bernoski from Workforce Development and Sue Dale Hall from Child Development Council about some of the issues that they are dealing with. So that is 11:30, Wednesday, June 3rd.
Martha, I have a question, and I want to see if anybody else has questions. So is the information that you're getting from folks who are coming to the committee, is it that they're asking for our help? Are the committee's help in doing some lobbying and some pushing, you know, for funding or to get these things continued? Is that what's going on?
Well,
just reporting.
Oops. Yeah, we haven't, well, reporting at this point. And the question of what do we do about these issues, we will spend time on committee goals. And I think that's really about what can we take on? In what kind of efforts we have, you know, do we want to take turns writing op-eds, you know, action alerts, you know, what kinds of things can we do with the information that we're gathering? And, you know, there are dozens of issues that all cry out, but what things should we really focus on? So that'll be a committee goal discussion, and I hope that we can come to a consensus. It's pretty open-ended at this point, and we really, I think, have to, as a group, figure out what makes sense for us to do.
Okay. And is that part of the agenda for tomorrow, sort of working through the goals? Great. I look forward to seeing them. Thank you.
Okay, you bet.
All right. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Callis, Chair.
I have one resolution, Resolution I, resolution of the Tompkins County Legislature as the elected legislative body of Tompkins County, New York, in accordance with Section 147F of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, as amended the code, approving the issuance by the Tompkins County Development Corporation of up to $36 million aggregate principal amount tax-exempt revenue bonds. This is the Ithaca College Project, Series 2020. And that is ID 9359. I'd like to move that.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Deborah Dawson.
I'll just note that this did move through committee unanimously, and it is a pretty standard refinance. So.
All right. Thank you, Anna. Any questions from anyone on the resolution? Any more discussion? No? Let's go to a roll call vote.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslin McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries unanimously. Anything else from you, Anna?
Yeah, I did want to mention that we talked about the CDBG program funding transitioning to you. You guys have all gotten this announcement at this point. The public has as well. We have almost $600,000 that is being used instead of renovations, which we cannot do at this time. They are going to be used for rent relief. That program has been designed in partnership with INHS. The program funds from the county can't be used in the city because the city gets its own CDBG funding, housing funding from HUD. And so they have 190,000 of their own. Once those funds are used up, the hope is that we would be able to apply for additional funding. As you all have seen, 150 were expected to be able to support about 150 households from the county, about 50, 54 from the city. So obviously it's not going to meet all the needs that we have, but it's a start. They also have a plan in place, which I very much appreciated, to reach people who do not have access to the internet and can't apply online. There's a phone number, there's outreach in place, and a mechanism for them to be able to keep their place in line, that they won't lose their place while they're filling out an application and sending it back in by mail, which is different than those who can apply online. So I appreciated all their efforts in making it as equitable as possible. We did talk about tourism briefly. There's a lot going on, obviously, in HED. There was a report given for all of the ACOD organizations and the steps that they are taking to reduce expenditures right now. They have now all been informed that their third quarter they need to reduce, or their grant will be reduced by 30%. So they're all working on that. And Nick has been working with them very closely to understand where they are, any concerns about continuing forward, activities that they are doing as alternates to, for example, being able to do live performances. And it is a day-to-day. You know, it's certainly a challenge because it is one of the most hard-hit industries because they depend exclusively on being able to meet in person. So stay tuned. We'll be getting information on that in this next meeting. I did want to acknowledge that HED activity is probably going to pick up over the summer. As the county goes off pause, you know, we will be dealing with trying to create as many solutions as possible to people who have lost their jobs, in redirecting work training, addressing the issue of people not being able to keep up with rent during this time. So Natalie will be really important from workforce development, conversations, plans. Jason obviously will be really important. The whole committee will be bent on trying to minimize the impact and doing rework, retraining. Jason and I haven't had a chance to talk about it extensively, but I know Natalie has been working on it. So those will be the focus areas. The last thing I'll say, Deborah and I will be working together more closely. She shared with me a presentation from NYSERDA. It turns out there is workforce development training. I've now read through all of that information. Deborah, extensive. Thank you so much. So trying to bring some of that funding in locally so that we can do a green infrastructure and a green economy regrowth as the focus in this area in particular, because there has not been a focus of that, surprisingly, in this area. So a lot. I know our next meeting is the 25th at 9:30. That is a Thursday, and that is my full report.
Thank you, Anna. Questions for Anna? All right. It's a lot indeed. Not a heavy lift. Complete Census Count Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Thank you. We met on Monday, and at this point, we were told the self-response rate in Tompkins County for answering the census questions is 57.6%. That we got a long way to go to get to our 100% full count. And that is our goal, though we're realistic as well. We continue to be hurting, particularly in the areas where there is a lot of off-campus student residences. A lot of those students have gone away because of the COVID crisis, and we're worried that they may count at their homes, wherever they're from, rather than as they're supposed to under the rules of the census and under the federal rules, count them here in Tompkins County. We know that we aren't the only college community that has these kind of issues. We did hear from our census representative, Michael Kaplinka-Lair, that the word is that at the congressional level, there may very well be a congressional hearing about the issue of how do you count with the COVID crisis, how do you count the college community populations so that they aren't crippled for the next 10 years because of what happened here.
Yeah.
That has not been scheduled, but it's apparently being discussed and it is in the works. The Cornell and IC particularly have been working very, very hard to get the word out to their students about this. We certainly commend those actions. TC3 has been working on it. They've been hampered by lack of staff out there to be able to work on it. But now, as things are emerging from the COVID crisis, they've been able to free up some help for that. We talked about a suggestion that came from Jennifer Carius, one of the census specialists that informed us in some areas the complete count committees have been doing subcommittees to try to focus on particularly difficult areas. One of those areas that we're worried about, of course, is College Town with all those student residences. And we are tasking our Public Information Advisory Board to work on that issue as to whether maybe they will be the subcommittee, for example, that works on this with the help of other folks that we can bring into that. For example, maybe there are local merchants in the College Town that could be helpful, or landlords that could be part of a committee that might help this. Rich John's name came up since it's his district, and there was a question about whether he would be involved with it, and I think I expect an affirmative response from him. I think he's very concerned about this as well. Those are the kinds of things we've been talking about, whether we'll get as good a count as we hope we could get remains to be seen, but it won't be for lack of trying. And I do want to mention that the actual census workers going door to door for those people who have not responded are starting to be out there. They came to my house on Sunday and left a packet, even though I assured them that I had responded. They said, no, this is our job. And they had a mask on, Martha, and it was they were very polite, and it was good to see them out there doing this. Did I miss anything, Amanda? Okay. So that's pretty much our report.
Thank you. I'm sure Rich appreciates the volunteering of him. Yay.
You should have been there.
Now it's dangerous not to go to a meeting.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mike. Again, another heavy lift in trying to get responses so we can make our numbers. Thank you so much for sharing that, Mike. Martha, you have a question?
Yeah, Mike, it's great to hear that the Congress is going to look at the college student issue on a national level. That's really the right thing. Is there any confirmed decision on the deadline for the overall count? Is it going to be moved back?
No, not exactly, but what they have moved it back to October already, and I imagine that's where it's going to stay because they've hired all these workers and they aren't going to be able to keep them going too far. We are expecting the data to come back in 2021 by the 31st of July.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Martha. Let's finish up our committees, and then I'll go back to Jason. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, anything from you?
Downtown Facilities has not met, and I guess I would refer to Jason to see if he thinks he's going to be in a position to do anything with that committee in the near future.
I think it's probably a conversation we should have, Dave. It's going to tie into budget one way or another. So maybe we can talk offline as to how you want to move forward with it. There's probably a budget discussion as well as a facilities discussion.
Very good. I'll get a hold of you sometime this week.
Yeah, let's talk offline. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Just let me know if you want to sell the red building. I'm looking for a new home. With the parking lot that comes with it.
Okay.
Public safety. Thank you, Dave. Public safety. Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. And welcome to my district if you're moving in.
Working on it.
Okay. Public safety committee did have a meeting. We had a report from Labella Engineers on their study of the conditions of the public safety building, including the jail. And it was a fairly detailed look. For those who haven't read it yet, spoiler alert, the building's pretty well used. It dates from 1986, and it's, 24/7 since that time. We are looking towards having to make some very difficult decisions on how do we move forward. One thing that we talked about a little bit was whether it would be possible to do some short-term improvements to improve functionality while we waited. And we basically got the answer that probably not, that would be money spent without a real return on it, other than some perhaps buying some new equipment that could be installed and removed. So we are heading towards having to make a difficult decision in a very difficult budget year. We probably would not be allocating money for quite a while, but the planning is still problematic. The engineers presented us with, I believe, 6 different scenarios with different costs. Building a jail or doing construction in a jail is an expensive proposition. There's a tremendous amount of engineering that has to go into the system to make sure it's secure. And you have to make sure that you have a place to put everybody while you do the construction. So there's a pretty large ongoing cost while you're doing the building. So, again, we started that discussion. That's going to go on, I believe, for some time, but we will continue covering that topic. The other thing I had mentioned from the public safety meeting is that we discussed there's been an uptick in domestic violence reports and domestic disturbance calls through the 911 system. This is probably no surprise given the shelter-at-home order. I anticipate at our next meeting we're going to have a report from the Advocacy Center and from the Sheriff's Department in more detail on this issue. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich.
Oh, I would add that we're going to meet June 18th at 3 o'clock. Sorry.
Thank you. That last bit of information is troubling. Questions for Rich? No? Thank you very much. Everybody is getting ready to go to sleep.
Leslin, if I could add one more thing.
Of course.
In 2019, the Sheriff's Department did a revamp of their policy and procedure on responding to domestic violence calls. They did training on it. And, of course, this was something that we discussed at some length. I don't want to leave the impression that this is not being responded to. The Advocacy Center and the Sheriff work very closely on these calls. And they're doing everything they can to make sure they're responded to appropriately.
Thank you. All right. Moving on. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Hi there. Thank you. We have not met since our last legislature meeting. Our next meeting is Monday, June 15th. And we have actually been leaving our agenda pretty open so that we could receive monthly updates on COVID. So I expect that Frank will be there with an update. And at some point, we are still actually getting reports from all of the department heads that report to HHS. If you are interested in receiving those, let me know. I know that all of the committee members in the HHS are receiving those. Feel free to join us in the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Shauna. Any questions for Shauna? No? All right. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Yes, we met on May 21st. A lot of what we talked about were the airport resolutions that we've already passed tonight on the consent agenda. But we did spend quite a bit of time talking with Barbara Ekstrom and about the Recycling and Materials Management Department, particularly the activity toward the sending out the request for proposals for the management of the solid waste facility, which will be for probably a five-year contract. They are, in one sense, it's a an opportunity to completely review what we're doing out there. But on the other sense, when we know what the markets are for a lot of recyclables, with the exception of cardboard, which apparently is doing pretty well. But they're all commodities, and right now with the change in what China's doing with the recyclables, we've been hurt, and so most places. We expect that there will probably be a request for an increase, perhaps a significant increase, in what we have to pay to have our recyclables processed through the whoever the successful bidder is on this project. There'll be a committee which will be looking at it once we start getting replies to the request for proposal, and we'll have more information on that as it happens. And did I miss anything?
Just thinking about the update that Jeffrey Smith sent out today regarding road work.
Okay, I haven't had a chance to read that.
So he said to committee members, maybe we should send it out to everybody. It was regarding work that they can start, a limited amount of work on several roads, mostly to do a surface treatment chip seal, which would extend the life of the roads, probably each road for 10 years. And then one road in Ulysses that they might be able to finish doing a little bit of work on.
That's good news. I'm sorry I hadn't read that before the meeting today.
It was just 2:30, so it was kind of late. I'll forward that to all the legislators.
Thanks.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you, Mike, very much for the report. Any questions for Mike? No. All right. Jason, you had something else you wanted to add?
Yes, I just forgot to mention, I think you all received the press release today. We were able to work with all the libraries in the county, and they were able to coordinate a limited reopening with curbside pickup at all their facilities. So we worked with them, I think, 2 weeks ago. We had our first conversation with them, talked about doing something in unison collectively. They were able to get together, and just want to give them the good shout-out and credit. They worked together. They were able to collaborate. I know I also want to thank Annette over at the Tompkins County Public Library, a much larger facility, some nuances to it, but they were able to plow through it all, and I think it's good to see that all the different libraries in unison collectively making that effort together. So we were happy to assist, happy to help with the communication, and good to see that they'll be providing some at least limited services. I think June 15th, I think, was the start of that. So good to see that.
Great. Thank you for that. That was the last of our committees. One thing I want to just add quickly, Jason, as you were reporting about COVID and people were talking, you know, I did hear from, it was in several meetings this week, and did hear from a number of small businesses how appreciative they were to receive the hand sanitizers and masks and so on from the county. That was a big burden lifted off of their shoulders so that they can open up their operations and get moving. So thank you for that. And it will be nice to
to be able to share that information if there are other people who need, to the extent that we have, that we can give out. So thank you. From them, they wanted to make sure that you and the legislature know how thankful they were, because it helped their businesses so much. If there is nothing else, I'm going to go ahead and – should we go ahead and take the minutes before we go into executive session? Yeah. No member filed resolutions at this point, so why don't we go ahead and move the minutes. Moved by Deborah, seconded by Amanda. Any corrections or additions, deletions, anything to the minutes? Martha, we did get a couple of things from you that, you know, were minimal. So thank you for that. All right. Roll call. All in favor of the minutes?
Deborah Dawson?
Aye.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis? Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Claymore?
Yes.
Sit down.
Thank you. That carries. All right. We're going to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing contract negotiations. Don't expect that we'll be taking any action in executive session. When we come back out, we will just move to adjourn. Okay, so we'll take a moment just to, I don't know what's supposed to happen.
Need a motion to go into executive
session. Oh, we need a motion to go into executive session. Moved by Dan Klein. May I have a second? Second by Rich John. Do I have to vote on it?
Yes.
Okay. We have to vote on it. Roll call vote.
Deborah Dawson?
Yeah.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis? Dan Klein?
Anna was having technical difficulties.
Yes, I just got a message from her.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Guess so.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
All right. We are in executive session.